From the Film Grok Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City, this is Film Grok. Our movie for this week is the 1964 Disney classic, Mary Poppins. My name is Serge Delpierre, and today we, on our esteemed panel, we have...
Tim McMillan.
And...
Michael Smith.
And...
Heidi Hilliker.
Our cue point for Mary Poppins is, at least on the DVD, is at once the Walt Disney Pictures logo fades completely to black. Just pause it there. That's what we've got it paused. And when we're ready to go, I will make the signal to Agnes, our Film Grok projectionist, and she will start the film. But we will count down 3, 2, 1, play before we do that. And then you can listen to us in sync while you're watching the movie, or you can just listen to this while you're driving to work or driving back from work or something like that. So,
or cleaning a chimney.
Oh, that's good. Or stepping in time.
That's right.
Or being a nanny.
Or feeding the birds.
That's true.
Or
eating a spoonful of sugar.
Yeah. Mm.
Chalk drawing on the sidewalk.
Or playing a, what do you call it when he's got the all the instruments?
The one-man band.
The one-man band. Yeah. Or breaking into songs from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Hmm. That's a stretch.
Yeah.
I rewatched it yesterday for the first time in many, many a moon, and I found myself going, wait a minute, this sounds a little like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang at one point. I'm like, okay. But that came afterwards.
Right.
So anyway.
You think they're trying to recapture lightning in a bottle?
I just think they were trying to write songs, and you know the Shermans just kind of fell into a tiny bit of a pattern.
So, I see your point.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it tend to happen. So we're going to talk about first times watching Mary Poppins, and then we're going to get started. So I'm going to go first, being the dinosaur of the group. I saw this when it first came out. So get out your calculators.
Did you see it in the theater?
I don't remember, but I had to because that's the way it was. So it was 1964. Actually, I looked up the release. It was August 29th, 1964, and I guess it was out, and it was the biggest moneymaker in 1965. So I guess, you know, films stayed out long and then continued. It's probably played 6-8 months. I remember as a child, what I do remember is I had the Mary Poppins soundtrack album, and I would listen to it incessantly on my little record player. And I listened to the, so that was a 33. I also listened to I had a 78 of Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, not sung from the, not from the movie. And then on the flip side was The Green Grass Grew All Around. I listened to that all the time too.
I love that.
It was a 78, not a 45 too. I'm like, okay. So I guess I must've been like 4 or 5 by then, but I must've seen it. Like, I asked my mom today, I said, so how many times we see it? She said, I don't remember. That was a long time ago. But we saw it a few times because it didn't appear on TV until, like, I guess the 70s or something like that. And we didn't have video, so you'd have to go to the movies. It was my favorite movie. I just loved that film. I don't remember it. I think I remember seeing it when I was like 8 or 9, and then I saw it again. And I felt it in a different way because I was a little bit older, but it was still my favorite film. And Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was my second favorite film until I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, and that was my number one film.
Wow. You jumped the track to 2001.
Really.
I saw that at the age of seven. I was like, okay, that's my favorite film. I loved space.
Wow.
And I just like, yeah, that's, but Mary Poppins always had a place in my heart. I played that record incessantly. But I also had a book. I guess it was a picture storybook, you know, what told the story and also had pictures from it. And the point I'm trying to make here is that at least back in the day before we had video, I mean, you'd see a movie and then you'd see it once, twice, 3 times, 5 times. But then that was it. You had to wait till it came back to a movie or came on TV. There was no video, you know, 6 months or a year later. So the books and the soundtracks and all those other things and, you know, all the merchandise became extensions of the film so that you can relive the experience of the film.
Right, keep it alive.
Yeah, exactly, without seeing it. So for me, Mary Poppins was very alive, even though in my lifetime I've probably only seen about 4 or 5 times, and that's it. But for me, it was very vibrant. I mean, I knew and I loved Mary Poppins. And at the end, of course, I'd cry because she'd go away. But I was a child, and that's natural. So watching it again, I'm going like, it was interesting. So it'll be interesting watching it with you guys. But it was an interesting experience watching it yesterday for the first time. Literally, I don't think I've seen it since the 80s. Probably saw it on videotape once. So that's my first time. Anyone?
Did you have the little, was it the book, was it a little golden book? You know that?
I remember the gold books.
Because I had a little golden book of
Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
But it was like pictures from the movie.
Yeah.
But some of them weren't like, they were slightly similar. Like there's one when they're in the chalk drawing world and the way it looked in the little golden book was like slightly different than the way it does in the movie. But it was really good. I don't know. I can't think of the last time I saw Mary Poppins, but it feels like it was yesterday. And I can't remember the first time I saw it, but it feels like I've always seen this movie. I mean, I know I had it on VHS when I was a kid. We had the soundtrack. I used to watch it with my grandparents a lot, like with Gigi and Sound of Music. Like there were certain movies we watched all the time, and this was one of them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's one of the, I have like an attachment to it because I think it's one of those films that's all about imagination. And it, you know, for children, obviously, I think that's really appealing. But if you ever had like an overactive imagination when you were a kid, I mean, you feel like, I think, really well represented in the Mary Poppins world. You know, like I didn't want to be the little kids. I wanted to be Mary Poppins. Like I had like a pretend bag that I thought I could pull stuff out of. Like who didn't want to do that after that? And the chalk drawing, I used to do that all the time. Try to draw drawings you could jump into. That
you didn't
work.
Jump into the sidewalk, did you?
I mean, I jumped on to it. I mean, really, it was just jumping up and then landing.
You can get bruised that way.
No,
so I just thought
I'd,
all right.
I hate when that happens.
But yeah.
So that's interesting. So you just remember always having seen it.
Yeah, it just feels like one of those things. I remember there was another film we did. And when we did It's a Wonderful Life, it's that same kind of feeling where right. I just feel like I'd always seen the movie and I can't remember a time before I had seen it. And it feels like you're
But it's
fresh.
Always been a constant.
Right.
It's always just been a constant.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And it's likely you probably saw it on TV. Well, actually, probably VHS. Your parents, like you just did.
I had it
Michael.
On VHS.
Yeah. You just told me that you tried you watched it with Logan yesterday, right?
A little bit. Yeah. We got about halfway through. And that was sort of an interesting thing. He he was kind of looking out, waiting for the Yo Gabba Gabba Gang to come out. But I'll give him a year or two more and see if he's not.
How old is Logan?
He's only a little over 14 months at this point. So.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. But yeah. So that'll be interesting. But once again, it's one of those things that would probably always be there. Now, what about you? How was that? Now, when was the first time you saw Michael?
You know, it's the same kind of thing. I just always remember that being there. So I can't remember a time before. Having seen Mary Poppins, it's just always just one of those films I've seen since I was really, really young.
Was it your favorite childhood film?
I'm sure at one point it was, but, you know, taste changed quickly as a child. But, right. Yeah, I'm sure there was a point in there where it was, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm asking that because for me, for some reason, it made such an impression, at least. Hmm. I always remember it's like, oh, that was my favorite
You know, yeah, I think for me, it's one of those, like, even when there were other films that were my favorite film, it was still a film that just, continue to resonate and continue to sort of stick with me.
Right.
Even when my taste changed to other things or whatever, like, you know, like not like 2001, but whatever, any other genre or whatever, that film was one that definitely still stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't be specific. It's always been a constant. It just always was in the air around me growing up from a little kid. I know I saw it in the theater as a real little kid. And then TV from that point on, every time it was on, it was always one of our, I always see films as far as what represents my home, and it was a unanimous home film. It wasn't just me, it was a family event, it was a reflection of the home, so we were all in agreement. If I fought with my brothers, if, you know, we tried to kill each other, whatever, we'd all come together to watch Mary Poppins.
Nice.
Either
nice.
As a family or as brothers, so it was a unifying film, I should say that. So it's very sentimental to me for those reasons. I find it interesting that for such sentimental reasons to be connected to a movie, Mary Poppins is overall a very unsentimental character.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she has these moments of darkness.
In fact, she's better than in the books, because in the books apparently
Softened her up.
They softened her up. Yeah, she's more vain,
which I find very interesting.
More cold.
What surrounds her, Bert in the film, and what surrounds her, Keenan,
Edwin,
are just these amazingly loving and up and warm and fuzzy people. But she herself is a bit of an island. She, you know, she doesn't let people in that much, I feel, in the movie. And she does that because she knows she has to go.
Right.
Yeah.
At the end.
Yeah.
From kid to kid when she has done her job, you know. I find that interesting. But I think for a Disney adaptation and for a Disney film, this is the pinnacle of the Disney machine working on full tilt.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Every department.
Yeah.
They struck gold. Musically, it's not a weak score. This is an incredibly strong, vibrant, melodic, well-structured musical,
right?
For a movie just being put together, that and then the production design, right. The art direction, the choreography,
the visual effects,
the costumes, the acting, the cinematography, and the direction. Robert Stevenson directed it, right? He was like the Disney go-to director,
the big one, yeah.
And this, I think, is his best work. He did 20,000 Leagues, right, as well.
Oh, did
Robert Stevenson.
He also did Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Oh, which
but,
I love.
But for me, Mary Poppins is the pinnacle of everyone's output for the Disney Empire at that point. So it's been a very sentimental movie.
It's the art direction that really stands out in this film.
Oh, everything does. Well, it was nominated for 13 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
That's like, there was only one film that was nominated for 14. I don't remember what it was. It's just like one film and that's it. But there's like, you know, the top films of all time have been nominated for 13. And won 5, one for... Best Actress for Julie Andrews, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Oh, that's right. A little controversy there.
It won for Best Film Editing. It won for Best Score. It won for Best Song, Chim Chim Cheree, and Best Visual Effects.
Well, right.
So
absolutely.
It took that away. Are we talking about the Audrey Hepburn My Fair Lady thing?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Which, for all you folks out in Film Grok land, let me try and see if I can tell this right, Tim. Originally, Julie Andrews had played Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady on Broadway.
She originated the role. That's very important.
And when it came time to do the movie, Jack Warner said, nah, I want Audrey Hepburn. So she lost out on that role, but then she got Mary Poppins, and then they were both up for the Oscar for that year, and Julie Andrews basically kicked Audrey Hepburn's ass and won the Oscar.
But maybe rightfully so, because she actually did sing.
Well, that's true.
And Audrey Hepburn didn't sing. She was dubbed.
I mean, Audrey Hepburn was wonderful, but she was dubbed by...
I don't know the girl's name, but it's the same person.
Marnie Nixon.
Yeah, she did West Side Story. She did Natalie Wood as well.
Natalie Wood, and she also did Deborah Kerr in The King and I. She was in Sound of Music. She played one of the nuns.
Yes, she was.
And in the movie, actually, there's a few more interesting things you can get off Wikipedia. It's a very interesting place. In the fantasy part, we're going to get started in a second, when they're in the animated part, one of the geese is Marnie Nixon singing. I think she does. I want to know what she looks like,
because why didn't she have a career, you know?
Watch The Sound of Music. She's one of the nuns.
She's one of the nuns in that. And then also David Tomlinson, who plays the father, at the end, you know, the handle over umbrella is a parrot, and he talks at the end? That's David Tomlinson.
Oh,
and he did, I think, one other voice in the animated part. So they kind of all chipped in there.
I think the chronology, the way it worked, was... Did Julie Andrews get Mary Poppins after it fell apart, My Fair Lady, for the screen?
I think it was.
I thought...
Or was it concurrent?
I thought Jack Warner asked to see some rushes from Mary Poppins to see if she was going to do My Fair Lady.
Oh.
And I think she was already doing Mary Poppins at that point.
I was rewriting history.
I could be remembering it.
Yeah, like maybe she wasn't able to do My Fair Lady because of the Mary Poppins.
Well, the big fear was that Julie Andrews, she was not a commodity as far as cinema. She was stage only.
Right.
That's the only thing she was known for. So does she photograph? Can she translate to the screen?
Right.
So that's why she didn't get it, because Audrey Hepburn was a proven cinematic commodity star.
Right.
And so they said, how does she photograph? So Jack Warner asked to see a bit of Mary Poppins, I think. And even with that, he still went with Audrey Hepburn. And Julie Andrews' speech when she won for Mary Poppins at the Academy Awards was, I'd like to thank everyone who made this possible, Mary Poppins. And she went through the list and she said, especially Jack Warner. And there's this huge, in the audience, everyone knowing how she meant that dig.
Right.
But she did it in a very classy, British, ladylike way.
Right.
So. I like the story as a Julie Andrews, Audrey Hepburn catfight. That's all I'm
doing. I like to, yes. All right, we're going to get started, and in the process, I'm going to talk about the books, too. Okay, so, Agnes, are you ready?
Yes, Mr. Dampier.
Thank you very much, Agnes. Okay, let's count down. 3, 2, 1, play. Thank you, Agnes.
First and foremost, Peter Ellenshaw should be noted right here. He did all the matte work and all the paintings.
The matte paintings in this movie are just amazing.
The visual effects
are
great.
You just don't see matte work like this
anymore. Did he work on Peter Pan?
He could have. Peter Ellenshaw was the main matte painter for Walt Disney.
Mm.
So he did Darby O'Gill and the Little People. He did a lot of effects for that.
Yeah.
But he was just one of a kind, and he's a maverick as far as old school matte artists. I'd say Peter Ellenshaw is the king of the crop.
I mean, this was in the book I was telling you about. This is the image that was, you know, the one that I remember that was like at the front of the book with her, actually we're coming up on it, with her sitting on a cloud. I always remember this. But this is great, even the way I'm looking at this, I'm like, yeah, I could figure it out, but I can't really figure it out. Because I think she comes up on the left.
Well, you know...
It's a separate shot, yeah.
One of my first thoughts about this film is the whole thing plays like a dream in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So the fact that it is a bit stylized with the matte paintings and everything, I think works for it rather than against it.
I agree.
Oh, no, absolutely. And then also, actually, thank you for bringing that up. The quality of each of their adventures is dreamlike. I mean, it's like, you know, like you said, I want to jump, you know, I want to jump on the sidewalk and go into it. That's the kind of dream logic.
Right.
Where in your mind, yeah, you just do it. And you, it's like you want to pretend and it will happen.
Even outside of that, though, the guy who's essentially a captain of the ship of London on standing, I mean, that there's a kind of dream logic in that. In the way,
neighbor.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, so that, the, I mean, even outside of their little adventures, I think the overall structure is still very dreamlike, too.
Interesting. Let's talk about a lot of the actors for a second. I know there's Hermione Baddeley, who's in this. She plays Cook.
Yep.
And then there's Rita Shaw.
Yep.
And
who I always thought was Retta by R-E-T-A. No, it's actually Rita.
Okay.
But it's spelled R-E-T-A.
Right.
And that, growing up, I always thought, oh, there's Retta, but I heard it's Rita.
Choreography by
Mark Brough and Dudi Wood, which they're incredibly accomplished. They also did The Sound of Music and Che Che Bang Bang.
Yes.
And
do we know at all if they came from stage?
Yeah, they did. And Dudi Wood trained under Michael Kidd, the choreographer. She was in Little Abner, the stage version, and she trained under Michael Kidd, and she actually then made the leap into films to do her own choreography by choreographing the film Little Abner, and that's what set her career in motion. And then Mark Brough, and they got married, and then they went into Mary Poppins from that point.
Oh, so this was their first collaboration?
As far as feature films, I can't say. I know they did like Judy Garland specials, a lot of TV together. But I think for feature, this Mary Poppins could have been their, this definitely made their career.
Right, yeah. Even if it wasn't the first collaboration, it was what they'd be known for.
Well, that's the thing is, I mean, that's, what did I remember the Mary Poppins for was the music. It was the one thing that was the entry. So the
song. Yeah, the music and the dancing. Well, and the colors,
and then
I guess,
the dancing,
too. And the
but
costumes.
That all supports it.
Yeah.
You know, the dancing, the choreography really made it. The choreography didn't.
But I think this is one of those first films that I saw growing up where I started noticing what choreography is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I started understanding the value of having a well-orchestrated, you know, dance number. Like in some things it just seems to happen.
Right.
But here it really accented the story. It accented the music. And there were new dynamic things happening that I had never seen before.
You've got to really point out Step in Time, the whole number that
it's
took... I mean, it's a jaw dropper.
I wanted to point something out here with his one man band. He actually introduces most of the melodies for the entire film here.
Well, he's falling on the heels of the overture, so that sort of
right. Well, they were definitely in the overture, but within the story
he's
itself,
reinforcing them.
He's reinforcing all the tunes himself, so but without the lyrics that we come to know later.
Right.
Let's talk about his accent.
No.
He's been under fire for this entire career.
Yeah, apparently, this is like voted the worst Cockney accent ever.
He admitted he didn't do any research. He just went in, showed up, and said, okay, Bert will talk like this.
That's why in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, he doesn't do an accent. He's just like, I'm neutral.
He got a lot of flack for his accent here, but it's fine.
Ooh. I forgave him. I'm
not
make a difference.
English, so I don't
it
have a big
add,
problem with
though,
it.
It does add, though, to that kind of animated, cartoonish, storytelling
heightened, stylized.
Kind of feel. Yeah.
Stylized.
I mean, it is the kind of accent you would see in animation, and probably no one would say anything about it.
Right. Yeah, but I understand from the English standpoint, because I know it drives me crazy anytime I hear an actor do a really terrible Southern accent. It's
demeaning.
But on a character like this, it adds.
Yeah.
And it's lovable, and it makes them more
context,
of a character. If
he
was, I still would have felt just as, you know, if he would have been a largely outblown Southern character, and I'm sure there's plenty of those I can't think of right now, but from, you know, this era of film, they still seem to keep an endearing quality.
Regardless, he's probably one of the most brilliant physical actors, since Charlie Chaplin, and put him with any other company. So,
absolutely,
that far outshines any.
Dick Van Dyke's body of work is amazing.
It's just,
he's unparalleled.
Oh yeah, I mean, he handled all the, you know, he handles the one man. Maybe he didn't play, but he certainly gave me the impression he clearly was playing it. Takes a lot of coordination.
It's believable.
As I said before, he's the most to me. He's the most sympathetic, fun character of the picture.
And then also,
he's the you. Well, you know, that I'm pretty sure that it is to most people, he's your guide. He's the person you're seeing this whole tale from the perspective of, maybe the children too, but.
Well, but that's the thing is, right, and exactly it. He's the only one who talks to us. He just turned to us, and he just broke the fourth wall. And now he does this like 2-3 times in the film. And he's essentially letting us into the story.
Great set.
You know, and he's also the second main character. We were introduced to Mary Poppins, though she didn't say anything, so we know who she is. Then we got him. He tells us where we are. He's talking to us, and he's introducing us to...
I forget his name.
Is it Command Admiral Boom?
I think it's what it, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Admiral Boom.
Boom, I think so.
Here we again, see that another first example of dream logic.
That's right.
Exactly. Out, yeah. And yeah, they're going to, and I like the ticking clock they set up, 3 minutes, 6 seconds. And then we show up later, we're in the house already in 3 minutes and 6 seconds when they're holding everything up. And actually, it's interesting, those, what he just said about Greenwich, that's from, they had some songs that were cut from the film,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the lyrics from one of the songs. They just incorporated it into it. Yeah, Wikipedia is great.
It is fantastic. What did we do before it?
It tells you a lot.
This was written in the 19... I mean, the original book was written in the 1930s?
Oh, yeah. Okay, let me talk about the books real quickly. The original book, Mary Poppins, was written in 1934. The follow-up, which I'm looking at right here, Mary Poppins Comes Back by P.L. Travers, who lived in Australia, was written in 1935. Then there were three other books, I think one in 1943, and then one in the 50s and one in the 60s. The first three involved Mary Poppins coming in and leaving, coming in and leaving, coming in and leaving. Finally, she said... we can't have her coming back and leaving. So the last two books were essentially adventures that happened during those previous visits with this family.
Interesting.
So, and then what they did is they collected, you know, moments from each one to basically make the movie.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So different adventures. They didn't all happen
from the first book.
Yeah, a lot of them apparently did, but not all of them did.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I like that, though, like picking through it all, you know, and picking the very best and sure. just featuring that.
Yeah, and that's where the dreamlike thing comes in. If you look at the descriptions of what the different things happen in the other books, it's like they're very dreamlike. Like they go on another planet. They go, you know, they go under. They have tea underwater.
Well, that was one of the things I was noting when I was watching it yesterday. Because it's interesting that it was written in the 1930s because that's when Freud and Jung were both doing a lot of their work. And I don't know if the writer was familiar with them at all, but there's some touches of that stuff. I don't know if it's just in the ether at that point.
There's a psychological underpinning. Actually, one other thing they did is, P.L. Travers objected to it a little bit, but then they wanted to move it to the Edwardian era, which I guess was 20 years before, which gives us a chance with the mother,
right.
like Glynis Johns. Oh my God, she's great in this.
She's awesome.
Fantastic. To basically about suffrage.
I actually think growing up, I didn't mean to scream there. I got excited. I think that this is how I learned about what women's suffrage was.
Absolutely.
I saw it. I was wondering what she was doing. I got the message through the movie. And then afterwards, you know, I'm asking my parents, I'm asking my grandparents, what is this? What does this mean?
Right.
But let me ask you this. Now watching this now, do you feel that maybe the narrative is sort of judgmental against her being part of that movement? And not being more active in her kid's life, I feel like there's a touch of judgment.
I think it does teeter on that.
I don't. I don't know. Maybe it's just my biases. I see being critical of the fathers.
It's overtly critical of the father, but I feel like there's sort of this other little bit kind of goes on that, even in the way her character is played, that she's a bit oblivious.
Well, I think that that's part of who she is as a character, and I think that's, I guess, what is being picked up, not so much on the movement, but that she is this kind of fantasiful, over-the-top woman, but she does actually, that type of a character does fit in more into this Mary Poppins world than mm-hmm. anybody else. She fits in more into this world with Mary Poppins and the children than anybody else in the household, than the father, than real life.
Right. I mean, she is a bit of a refraction of Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
In a kind of way. Wow.
She's definitely a bohemian.
And also, I mean, this was the early 60s, and this was definitely more of an issue that was coming up at
right.
the time.
Well, that's kind of what I'm wondering. Is this a reflection of the time in which the film was made, and that there's a bit of judgment on that movement of the... Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I feel like there's a touch of it there.
You know, I did not even read it. I mean, I think it's great because it actually... What it does is it helps... I'm sorry, Tim. It helps to define her as a person as opposed to just being the meek... Yes, dear, I will do whatever you want, and having no identity. She's carved out an identity for herself. I mean, you want to talk about psychologically. Here, psychologically, she's saying, I'm a person like you. I can get the vote. Whereas if you take that away, then what is there? She's just a dutiful wife who's trying to take care of the kids, and then, you know, there's the nanny, and that's about it. It doesn't give her anything active. This gives her something active to do and someone to be.
But if she's so complete, then why, within the structure of the narratives, then are the children kind of out of whack in the beginning? It would seem then, is that all on the father, or is that not
on
her too?
When I saw it yesterday, I read it as all on the father. Tim?
I think the film's making a comment that, yes, this is what she wants, and she wants to become independent and exert and herself and her identity, but she's a prisoner of her time.
Yes.
That's the comment it's making. And it's showing you how far women have come And thanks to women like her, but even women like her were a prisoner to be who they could be completely at this point. But the germ, the seed is there, and she wants to move in that direction, but she's crippled by society and the ways around her at the time of trying to do it. I think that's the comment that the film is making.
Right. Well, and in her defense, I do think there is a comment here, and I do think that, you know, and it's something, I think it's something worthwhile to even take the time while we're, you know, watching this movie to talk about, you know, that there is a balance and there was a shift going on in the 60s with women being at home or being in the workplace, and that, you know, people are starting to realize, and I think it's something still people are starting to get used to, is that balance that, you know, between being independent and being in the home, you know, it's a shift between two completely different archetypes for women. But here in this film too, I feel like even if this woman wasn't so into politics in this time, in this Victorian time, she still wouldn't have been a good mother, because women of a certain class in London society wouldn't have been, they would have had a nanny anyway, even if she wasn't trying to win for suffrage. She would have been a socialite. She probably would have been even more vain, even more flighty, and would have just been serving her husband's bank, you know, officials and trying to make a good impression in society.
You need to go through two filters, the time, chronology of the date, and British. You need to put British society in that time equals what we're seeing.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And that's so she's just a woman of the age rather than
Then it being her identity herself that's doing this.
Right.
Interesting.
The seeds for so much more are there, and that's who she truly is, but I think she's suppressed.
Now, what's interesting is how we've been introduced to...
I said oblivious. No, he's truly oblivious.
Oh, he is oblivious. Yeah. Well, he's the man. He comes in, he's the man in the house. Now, we've been introduced to everyone. We were introduced to Mary Poppins. We don't really see her for a little while now, but we're getting the whole family life. We've seen everyone, and he comes in last, and he says, "I am the lord. You know, I am the lord of my castle." At 601, at 602, 603, everything is structured. Everything is, you know, this is my manifest destiny. This is my time, and everything serves me, which was an attitude from that time, and I think that attitude definitely extends to
1960s,
because that was a mentality of the 50s.
Absolutely, even in the 60s, right. It was still a mentality, and that was definitely, I mean, that was part of what was changing, and this was picking up on it, and this is what, very gingerly, but you know, by putting it back in 1910, was saying, well, maybe we can gently change this with a lot of, you know, sugar, spoons, heapfuls of sugar on top of it.
It's beautiful that this film begins this way, because it brings you into an environment that we are ignorant of today, but it's showing us, it's letting us absorb an environment foundationally before the rest of the movie.
Right.
But with lots of music and making us feel good.
We don't lose interest whatsoever.
And big characters. They're all still big characters, you know.
Wonderful introductions on all sides for us to learn this world.
But, you know, actually, we haven't met the children yet. That's interesting.
This is just one of those films.
Just laid out, it's amazing.
This is one of those films that, like, every frame, I feel like, was meant to be there, you know, and there's very few films you can say that.
There's
always
a
bunch of throwaway. Yeah, but there's just like every frame just feels right in this film, and I love that about this film.
Also, the way they introduce the kids is through mystery, and also Mary Poppins. We've seen her, we haven't seen her in action. The kids, all we've heard is that they're trouble, you know, and they are a force here, and we then get introduced to them. It's like Harrison Ford, literally, at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark. We see him from behind, and then he turns into the camera.
I know. By the time you see him, you expect him to be like wielding a bat or something, and then these two like meek looking little kids. It's great.
Who are, and here they are, and I got to tell you, they are two pretty darn good actors,
child actors. Yeah.
Oh yeah, they're fantastic. Really are. There were lots of things around this time. There were other Disney films.
Matthew Garber, who played the boy, died very young.
Oh really?
Yeah, he died very young.
Oh, he's really good.
I want to say like before he was like 14 or something.
Oh, wow.
No, no. How did he? We should look that up. Yeah, he died very young.
All right. Oh, my gosh. I'm looking it up. And aren't they cute as a button?
Now I'm bummed.
Cute as a button.
And coming back to what we were talking about, the Freudian and the Jungian sorts of things, the chasing the kite, very much a dream image dream symbol and that sort of thing. So.
And that's Arthur Treacher, who's the Bobby.
That's right. From Arthur Treacher's fish and chips restaurants.
Well, he was known for other things before that.
I know that, but seriously, but that's the Arthur Treacher.
And we should have done a shout out to Elsa Lanchester, who played the first nanny who stormed out,
and who
Bride of Frankenstein.
Bride of Frankenstein, and she was also on a great Night Gallery episode called, I think, Green Thumbs. And she did a lot in between.
Very accomplished stage actress, married to Charles Laughton, very much part of the theater.
That's right. And then also Rita Shaw was on Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
Yep.
Hermione Baddeley was. I think the thing I remembered her from was Bewitched, which Rita Shaw was also on. But I remembered Rita Shaw from Ghost and Mrs. Muir. One of my
Rita Shaw was a character actress who did everything.
Yeah, I love the Ghost and Mrs. Muir. It was a great TV show.
Great film too.
Well, I saw the TV show first as a child.
And Glynis Johns went on to, of course, she was a very trained British actress, but she did theater, and she had a huge success in a Sondheim show. I forget which one it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, wow. Later on.
Oh, there's a kite. That's right. Mm. Which comes back, and I see that it's planted at the beginning, and then mm-hmm. it comes back at the end. And of course, you know, of course,
which the family unites to all fly
yeah.
together.
Right.
And yeah, the ego kite in the beginning is sort of lost in the wind, and then here it is at the end. And,
ooh.
Yeah. I'm telling you, there's a lot of like psychoanalytic.
And look,
of
he's wearing red.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
But I backed you up.
It's a smoking jacket, but.
You know, I was telling my wife yesterday she had to give me a smoking jacket for Christmas after I saw this.
Yeah, right. His is really classy, too, with that kind of quilted material.
Yeah, it's just interesting watching Glynis Johns' performance with him. I mean, how she's balancing her stretch, her desire to achieve essentially suffrage, but she's still, you know, she's not bristling against where he is.
Yeah, she's confident in her world as soon as she steps in with him. She's right. Little, yeah.
But she's still confident. She knows how to work in his role because that's what it is. It's like everyone revolves around me.
Well, you never get really the indication or feeling either that she might be slightly stifled by him, but never that he's like abusive overbearing.
We never fear never. For her.
No.
No, that you just get the feeling that this is a slightly dysfunctional family, not completely out of whack by any means, just, you know, a bit off.
Well, they all want the same thing. They just don't know how to, the roundabout way of getting there yet. Yeah, you know, exactly. That's why they need a guide.
Yeah,
if only we all had that, you know, with our dysfunctionalities in our families, if someone could just step in and just say the things that are obvious.
There's a lot of repression, actually, in the film.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot of repression for each character.
Even for Mary Poppins.
But that's of the time, too. I mean, this is Edwardian England. You know, it's 1910. It's just plain England also. And also, but that gives you a lot of latitude to play with mores and pointing them out.
These children are awful.
They did another film. What was that film? Something about Thomasina, another Disney film about
Thomasina.
A cat.
Well,
hang on.
Something Lives of Three Lives or something about Thomasina.
The Gnomobile.
They did the Gnomobile, yeah.
Yep, they did the Gnomobile.
They had a little franchise.
She did the lives, Three Lives of Thomasina.
What else did she do?
I'll find out in a second. He died at 21 in 1977 of...
Wow.
Hemorrhagic necrotizing pancreatitis.
Oof.
Wow.
Apparently he contracted hepatitis.
And it was very young.
That is very young. That's really sad. Yeah. He looks like my little brother.
No,
that's really sad.
He's like a little man.
He's like a little man.
He's like, I'm here.
But she's like a little, they both are actually. They're very adult for
they
children.
Have, they yeah. have
old souls.
Old souls, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Old soul eyes.
She was born in 56. No, 55.
And her name?
Karen Dotrice.
Dotrice. Okay. A lot of high key lighting in this.
Yeah, there is. I noticed that yesterday too.
This is very bright musical.
Oh yeah. Well, but it's suitable for this. She
be happy.
But it makes. But it actually it's good because in comparison to what happens later on in the film when it gets darker and the darkness they use
it does really seem to accentuate that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Psychologically, towards the end, especially when he walks in and he's about to get fired and it's lights, you know, everything's dark and you see this pool of light and the red and the table. It was great. You know, very dark.
Looking to see if the little kids have bloodshot eyes all that light being
pumped
on them.
This is still in the era when they had, you know, lights the size of small trucks just to make it show up on film.
It wasn't shot in Technicolor, but it was processed by Technicolor. So
now I want to do a bit of
less light.
I want to do a bit of a shout out here to a guy by the name of Pogo. Actually, his name is Nick, I think, Bernke. He's a musician on the internet. He's posted stuff on the internet, and he did a remix of using this song, and he basically cut it all up, and it's called, if you don't go on YouTube, you look up Pogo and Expialidocious. It's absolutely, I love it. It's fantastic. He did a really, really great job with it. And he basically used, they use that as the basis, but he sampled her in this song, and then he samples different parts of different songs to put something together.
Speaking of YouTube homages, there's a clip, I don't know what you'd put in the search window, but it makes Mary Poppins like a horror movie.
I've seen that.
It's a trailer or something?
It totally works.
Yeah.
I mean, if you probably just look up Mary Poppins horror movie or trailer. Yeah, it is.
She's that coming is for the children.
Wonderful.
It's really creepy, though. There are a lot of, like, in the darker parts of the movie, it is pretty dark.
It's like Willy Wonka. He goes really dark. And you're like, do you want this man around children?
I think there's a Willy Wonka one like that as well, the horror movie kind.
You know, but speaking on that, you know, I think that's one of the things that really resonates when you're a kid, when you see something like Willy Wonka or even the darker moments of this, and you have those kind of moments in a movie, that makes it feel so much more real to you than anything that's really completely sugar-coated all the way through.
Because
you already sense as a young kid that there's a lot more darkness and a lot more sort of difficult things
to be scared from.
But I think that's something that I unfortunately see lacking a lot in things marketed for children and families nowadays.
Agreed.
Absolutely. But if you think back, we talked about this during the Planet of the Apes ones.
Miyazaki may be an exception.
You're right. Oh, yeah.
But that's Japanese.
That's Japanese, yeah.
That's true, but it's at least starting to be seen here.
For example, the Planet of the Apes films, which kids really liked back then, those are actually, when we do them, they're dark.
Those are horrendous for children.
But we liked them as kids.
But even look at this. Yeah. Look at this. Look at Willy Wonka. Look at Pinocchio. When I was younger, it was petrified of Pinocchio, but I would watch it all the time.
Well, Disney traumatized children in his stories. You look at Bambi and the mother being shot, Pinocchio being swallowed by the whale. As I said, we watched some other Disney film and I said this. I had psychotic breaks as a kid through all these Disney movies.
But I like
my mom kept taking me back and she had to take me out of the theater because I was screaming my head off.
But it's like Grimm's fairy tales and Hans Christian Andersen. Like, those kind of stories are still set up with bad things happening. Like, they're still, those are way worse than even the early Disney versions of them.
It's about surmounting the bad things. And at the end, you go through them. And it's a good thing to teach a child that you can go through it rather than you have to only sidestep it, you know? This is great. The harness work and the wire work.
Oh, it's very good. Actually, I wanted to point out the dog. This dog shows up all throughout the film.
Dog.
It's Andrew. He's a little witness to most everything in this film.
Well, that's an old sort of film technique. When you need a little something, you just cut to the dog.
It's like the dog in Absent-Minded Professor, Fred McMurray. It's the same type of thing. But this is very advanced wire work for 64.
What I love about this from a story point is that, okay, so you have the archetypal nanny sort of figure, and it's like, if you take this as sort of almost like the kid's dream, it's like they're completely dismissing all these variations of the archetype, just blowing them away to bring in the one they really want, the more sublime version of that archetype that they're looking for.
Their reactions are
She's not
going to
be upstaged.
Yeah.
She's going to get rid of. Yeah. Another great matte painting there.
Yeah.
And
so
just
many
like
amazing matte paintings.
Flawless, you know, overlay with her coming in. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I don't even know how they do it.
I love this, where she dips down and goes over the fence.
Yep.
Even
rather
the
than just
silhouette
over,
is coming down.
But down,
there.
And then goes up and over.
And look how great of a physical actress she is. Yeah. You know, the way she's holding her feet, where she's kind of pointing her toes up as she's flying. Like, you know, I'm sure there's a reason why maybe you need to do that in order to fly. Maybe, you know, there's...
Well, again, you need to realize in context, she had never been before a film camera for a feature film. This was the first gig she ever had movie, and she nabbed an Oscar, and she did a character like this. I mean, look at it in context. You know Julie Andrews is Julie Andrews. This was not Julie Andrews. No one knew of her. She hadn't done a film. She was an unknown commodity film-wise in every sense, and she hit it out of the park. She was born to do this. This is who she is. She's a wonderful craftsman professional. But of course, she started when she was like 8 or something, singing and being in front of theater and stage and the Toast of London and all this. But this is her first big film gig.
Yeah, I saw some footage of her when she was younger doing stuff, and it's just amazing.
I think she had her 4-octave range for like since 10 or something, I think. Yeah. Perfect casting. Who could be better in this role?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, no one.
And I really like the fact that she comes in. It's not like you're hiring me. It's like I'm deciding to stay, and I will stay for this amount of time. And
going back to Glynis Johns' character compared to Mary Poppins, with how she's asserting herself,
absolutely,
and confidence and identity in this Victorian time, please.
And he's befuddled. And actually,
not Victorian. It's Edwardian.
This is Edwardian.
Yeah,
Victorian was 20 years before that. The way they play this is that he's got the cognitive dissonance. He cannot make sense of
what happened with the letter. Because he has no imagination.
And it keeps on being drawn out. He still can't. And she uses this befuddlement to get what she wants. In fact, she uses this later. He's completely at her mercy, in a way.
I have to make a little comment about the costume design on this real quick, because the look of Mary Poppins is the completing of a character. Someone could draw a quick caricature of that hat, you know, the way she wears her coat, her umbrella, and you would know instantly that's Mary Poppins. You know, it's a very signature trademark look from the get-go, from the second you see her.
One other thing, importantly, they are the only ones to see her magic.
Mm-hmm.
Them and Bert. The parents never see it. They never witness it. And in fact, there's one point where...
So it's the ones who can believe in it.
In fact, they do try and mention it at one point, and she like looks at them and says no, or something like that. Like she shakes her head, and that's like later in the film. So I thought that was interesting.
I think it's as a state of the heart, that if you're open in your heart to being open to seeing it, you'll see it.
And see, he's still there. He still can't make sense of it. I mean, they've drawn this out for like 2 minutes. Has anyone seen Nanny McPhee?
Yes, no. I saw the first
Emma
one.
Emma Thompson's take on Mary Poppins?
How was it? How did it compare to this?
I mean, it's a similar type of a story for a new generation. You know, it's based on books as well, which I don't know, you know, maybe those books are better written. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't read either sets of books. Is it comparable to Mary Poppins? No. Is it fun? Sure. Yeah.
Is Nanny McPhee magic?
Nanny McPhee is magic.
Mm. But she's ugly.
Yeah, but she's ugly, but she's like really pretty on the inside, you know, like that scenario, that scenario right there.
And that's the thing. I'm sure kids like it.
But I really did like it, and they made a sequel.
If you put it side by side with a young child, would they prefer Mary Poppins or Nate? We should do a focus group.
Well, they would.
Well, you have a focus group there, Michael.
Yeah, true.
It depends on what they've had exposure to, though, I think. You know, if they never watch any classics, they probably won't have a love for it. It'll look old to them, I think.
Yeah, I think for us, having the iconic imagery of Julie Andrews as Mary Poppins, you're fighting against that iconic imagery. So how, you know, that's
very
tough.
Biased.
That's very tough.
Is Nanny McPhee a musical?
No.
I think that's what might give
us
the
edge.
This is a musical.
This is what might give us the edge.
I think Julie Andrews.
Team Mary Poppins, go.
Team Nanny.
Team McPhee, boo. That's right. Because the music, once again, is the thing that you can take away from the film. You don't have to be watching the film. You don't have to recite the dialogue. You can sing the songs.
Amazingly well done work from the Sherman
from
Brothers.
The Shermans. They were awesome. It was fantastic.
And supposedly the legend is that Walt Disney, no matter how many years later, would always call the Sherman Brothers in because they were under contract to work for him. And at the end of a work day, when it was all quiet, Walt Disney would want them to play Feed the Birds on the piano that was in Walt Disney's office.
That was my favorite. Not favorite song to sing, but it was the one that made me cry when I was a kid when I saw this. Of course, this whole... Yes?
I was going to say this is it. There's another symbol that you see this sort of boundless feast idea, except in the bag here, this bag that just keeps giving
because
and giving.
Because the bag
giving.
Is your imagination. It's so brilliant.
Yeah, no, it's such a nice way of really... bringing her in like this. Here she is, this woman with this boundless imagination, you know, and
now notice this
unending gifts essentially.
Right. And now notice this, who's captured by the imagination, the why have I forgotten her name already, but the girl, whereas the boy, like his father, is trying to figure out the reality of it. How did it work? How is this working? I don't understand. And of course, the visual effects in this and how they made this with the cuts and everything is absolutely, you can kind of see it, but it's really almost flawless. And we're looking at a remastering, right, Tim?
Yeah, I think it's a remastered.
Yeah,
disc.
The gag with the boy, I think, was also a little bit of there's nothing up my sleeves to let's show a kid underneath the table looking up so that we can show.
But it's the boy that's the whole thing.
It works, but
it works from a character standpoint. It works from a technical standpoint as well.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. We've got to show the trick is still working. And I like this. And this is actually a practical effect.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on in a second, what she does with the hand. I think that she gets annoyed. And she does that. That's all practical. and once again, the trick is reinforced. So there's definitely the magic, the whole thing of magic, which is nice. And then, of course, now we basically get introduced to her standards, you know, how let's measure you. And it's not a matter of measure of height, but it's a measure of character.
And it was really that kind of brought me to the idea of the comparison to some Freudian sorts of things, because you have in her the kind of idea of the superego and of perfection and of trying to, you know, constantly look for perfection. Whereas with Dick Van Dyke, he's got more of the id thing going on and sort of the impulses and those sorts of things. So it's an interesting back and forth between those two.
I will challenge you on that. I will turn it around. Actually, perhaps she is the id. She is Loki, essentially. And the superego is the father. Or actually, no, let's do it. Oh,
I want to know.
It depends who you're focusing on, because actually, it's not the kids. The kids are being allowed to be kids. Their imagination is being allowed to roam. But notice for the first hour and a half, it's with her, and then she kind of disappears for a while, and then it shifts to the father, and it's the father's lesson that he has to actually be active and participatory in his children's lives, which is what changes him. He's the one with the arc.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, absolutely.
He's the one. So actually, it's his story without him being the main character.
You could argue that if in the dream sort of language, that the dream is his.
Yes, even though we're not introduced to him. That's kind of odd structure, because Bird, in a way, is our entry into the world. But he's not the main character. He's a supporting character. So he's like Chorus, really.
Right.
And actually, interesting about Bird, I want to mention this before.
I thought you were talking about the father. Not.
Well, I switched to Bird. But Bird is actually, and this may play into the whole psychological thing, is... he's an everyman in the sense that his job changes from day to day. So he truly is an everyman. He is truly Chorus in that sense.
Now, but Eric Tomlinson is the one who has the character arc in this film. He's the most changed.
He's
the father.
He's the one who...
And Mary Poppins exits the way she came in, basically. She is...
But she comes in and she does her job. She's like James Bond. She has no arc.
Yeah.
Nothing changes. She knows what she can do. She gets in there. She has the challenges. She has the obstacles.
And they allude to our Mary Poppins and Bert and Item, actually. They have that.
They do allude to that. I always thought that when I was a kid.
Yep.
I always thought that was real life.
They're sweet on each other.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. And actually, that more comes out in the fantasy sequence, because her behavior changes in the fantasy.
Chalk painting.
In the chalk painting, as opposed to this reality. Right. I mean, she's nice with him.
So you could have had a prequel with their whole thing, you know?
But then it's fun is to use your imagination to think what happened. I used to always try to figure that out. What happened?
Well, that's
animatronic bird.
The bird is well done.
Oh, yeah. The cable's hidden behind her arm.
Yep.
Oh, all,
and she handles it very well too.
All the effects. I want to talk about the effects.
Here's a huge
sequence, which are great.
Reverse.
So that was reverse. Yes, that was handed off to her. So that goes into that, and of course.
But when she goes up the banister, that wasn't reverse.
This is a blue screen, but that was reversed.
Yeah, reverse. Look at the inertia of how it's moving.
So they pulled everything back with strings, I guess. This, I don't know how they did. Obviously, it was reversed, but did they just dump everything out?
Yeah,
they just dumped everything out, I think.
Could have tilted the stage.
They definitely
had to do it in sections because it wasn't all, didn't all happen at once.
They definitely cleaned up the blue screen, too.
Yeah, as far as the remastering.
Oh, yeah, because
in 64, there were a lot of lines.
Yeah, and I like how he can't get the snap.
Snap going,
That was cute with the blocks. Yeah. And obviously, that was two shots.
Oh, you remember that as a kid, the first time you were trying to learn to snap, and you just couldn't get it.
I still can't snap with my left hand or whistle, so I feel you, kiddo.
You have to really understand how dazzling this sequence is for 1964, and... just the entire effects are just
I'm not laughing at you. That is so cute. Okay. All right. Well, we'll have Film Grok snapping lessons after this.
Snapping lessons. I can do it with my right hand, you know. I can make this happen.
But you're right-handed, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, this is trippy if you want to go psychological.
Yeah.
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 Oh, yes.
With ids and egos and...
Michael, go for it. Do it.
She's cheeky.
This is her id. She has... And she does, and that part of her never reappears again. That was just a little. It's a little touch, but it shows the magic. It's another. She's disconnected from not even physical laws.
Well, just part of the dream language of the film.
Right.
Absolutely, it's all dream language.
You know what's interesting too is there's a touch of this as a beginning of the teacher genre that becomes so stale later on. I think. You know, where you have these sort of unruly kids that need to learn
a lesson.
A lesson. And which is now so played out, it's ridiculous. But it you know, this
but that was yeah. But that was always been around, and that's I mean that's what a lot of children's stories and you know especially well if you look at the children's books for bedtime, all they're about is about the child going to sleep and it's a good thing and all that. And, but even the Grimm's fairy tales, it's all about you know if you behave this way, these are the consequences, and learning that through story
within. Film genres.
That, oh, no, I understand, but film genres extend the whole
life,
the stories, because kids don't just watch movies. They read books or have books read to them, and all the stories essentially feed, the more effective ones, feed how to, you know, interact, how to behave within a household, which actually, really interesting thing, too. This gives like a clear, there's not many films that give you like a clear outline of how a whole household works together. This one does. You've got a really good idea of how everyone interacts with everyone else. And how often do you really see that in a movie? You often see characters isolated from their parents or, you know, or from their children, and you see bits and pieces, but you never see the interaction.
Oh, going back to your comment earlier about there aren't a lot of children's films that allow darkness, I think Where the Wild Things Are is definitely a notable exception to that, too.
Right.
I would agree, but I think that that film was made less for children and more for the children of the book fan. You know what I mean? Like, I think that was
I didn't watch it that
aim.
Way, but I can certainly see that.
So that's why I think that still got in there, you know?
I am in agreement.
Right into another song. There's not much space between the two.
No, it keeps it up. Actually, going back to you know the song, Just a Spoonful of Sugar. I mean, that's what it is. You keep on getting the songs are the sugar. They're always sweet,
right.
And it always feeds you, and it strings you. And he's talking to us again.
Yeah,
it's a great melody line in this song.
Watch his physical work just in this scene alone. His legs are just like the rubber. It's amazing.
Right. Oh, I want to go back to one point. The moment we see Mary Poppins like somewhere in the 25-minute. Or I don't know where we're like close to the 30-minute mark, but we hear her names for the first time at 31 minutes. So kind of right at like the act break. Though it could be argued that this is the act break.
Yeah.
It is a slightly longer film. It's actually 2 hours and 20 minutes for a kid's film.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's really long.
It's like the Godfather
film.
It's the Godfather kids
film.
No,
it doesn't.
This film
it has
is 2 hours
maybe a couple
and
moments there in the middle where it drags a bit, but otherwise.
Well, it drags. Yeah, once it goes away from her, that's when it starts dragging.
Yeah.
I've always noticed is just with me personally. To me, when he turns into the older guy in the bank, that's when it drags for me.
Yeah, exactly. But
the whole song and the whole thing with the older guy in the bank and the bank sequence really just comes to a standstill.
Because that's when it goes away from her. That's when that's part of psychologically what the whole thing is. The father has to. It then becomes the father's journey. So she's, in a way, she's training the kids to use their imagination, and she's kind of like taking the household somewhat through this journey by, I guess, by inference. You know, they catch little glimpses and little things. Like, for example, with the song Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, which comes up soon in this sequence, they say it, and he's like, he can't process it. You know, this is cognitive dissonance. I don't get what you're saying. And so then she says, yeah, fine. Remember, she talks him into it. She says, go to the bank with them. She sends him off, and he fails. And not only that, well, he doesn't fail, but actually the kids bring chaos into the bank. But it becomes his story in a way. She hands it off to him, and then she comes back. So that's why it's a different kind of thing, and that's why it seems like it slows down.
And the bank is chosen very carefully to be his occupation because that is the most controlled representation of establishment.
Absolutely. And his whole life is all about control. He says, I come home, my home is like my work. You know, everything, 601, 602, 603.
In order.
Everything's there for me.
He makes the nannies wait outside because he doesn't want to be rushed. He wants to do it at the right moment, at the right time.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, he's losing his tooth there.
Yeah, look, it was discoloring a little bit.
I'm sure he probably lost it during the film and he had to wear a fake one.
Maybe.
Oh, man, look at that.
Oh, that would be hard.
Can't wait till Blu-ray comes out. We can really see it.
Uh-huh.
And I like how she's just so nonplussed. Like, yeah, way to go, buddy.
But there's a history there. I think
because she knows
things in the past that she's relating to this moment.
She does seem like she has like a little underlying, you know, bit of amusement.
Right, but she's trying to show the front to Bert that she's not going to be moved.
Right. I mean, she's being the nanny. She's being, I am guiding the way. Now, here, this is the one mess up I didn't like. That's fine, but on the reverse, the angles don't match because they're standing up right now. How is he reaching down to do that?
Sidewalk would be very high.
Exactly. He wasn't.
That's
a
cheat.
That's a bit of a cheat. I can live with that.
Thank you, Heidi.
But he's standing up a little bit too. He's not sitting down.
You're getting picky
Bert has. That's my only. Elasta arms.
Is my only nit with this film. It is the only one.
Well, that's the only one.
We got a guy with a cannon on a roof, but you're bothered by the cheat.
I'm bothered by the film language. It's got to match. Come on. I like how he wants to try it, and he's the one who can't do it, but he knows about it.
Yeah, it's interesting that
he's trying to get Mary Poppins to do it. He's being manipulative here.
Well, I like that she just doesn't want to do it, and she's like, oh, what are you doing? And she's just watching it. He's like, what are you guys doing?
And I like the almost kind of role reversal flip here in that in a lot of stories, his kind of character of being the character of impulse and that sort of thing would drive a lot of the magic, but it's really the more structured character, Mary Poppins, is the one with the magic. It's an interesting flip.
And now this is my favorite part of the whole movie.
And now her personality her personality has changed here. She's like, her personality changes to the, to what the fantasy is.
I get the feeling that she relaxes because she's completely in her element.
Look at that. She's completely changed here.
She's not when she's in, the real world.
Yeah, for whatever
this
reason.
This is
her
environment right here.
I don't know. She seems to me pretty much comfortable wherever she is.
She was, but she was stricter out there. Here she's relaxed.
Soft,
she's
vulnerable.
She's like, yeah,
feminine.
And she lets them run off by themselves. Yeah.
Exactly. And now this is their time. And
can be seen as a love interest.
Mm. She is not the nanny here. She's like, oh, go play, children. This is the fantasy.
Yeah, she doesn't have to worry about anything.
Now, of course, this is all done on blue screen. And then
huge effect sequence for the time.
I guess what they did is they would take it, they would then make mats from it, and then they put it down and they animated the butter, everything in front of it. They put the backgrounds in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing.
And it's a tracking shot. I love that. Look at the background. It's great.
Right. So.
But it's perfect for the limitations of the technology at the time too. Like, put them in a painting and then paint it.
But it's very much a Disney, spectacle. I mean, Disney's animation, so they're going to take and do this.
Yep.
It's animation in a live film, so it's the perfect Disney compromise.
Right, and I think this was the first one where they did this. No, they did it a bit in Fantasia, did they?
They do
live
it,
action with
live act.
They
live,
do it a lot in Songs of the South.
Song of the South.
Which was earlier.
Yeah.
We don't talk about that movie anymore.
Ben
Ubs
and
Broomsticks would be a better example.
Ben Ubs and Broomsticks.
That was my favorite example as a kid when they did that.
Ben Ubs and Broomsticks.
When they go into that world in Ben Ubs and Broomsticks. Right.
After this. That was in 71. That was 7 years later.
That was the first movie I ever actually saw in a movie theater.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Well, I think the first film to do that was the one with Gene Kelly where he danced with Tom and Jerry.
Anchors Away,
yeah. And that, I guess, was sometime in the 50s.
Nope, that would be Anchors Away was like 46 or 5 or something. Yeah.
Yep. Now, here, actually, the animation had changed.
Maybe 48.
Disney's style of animation had changed. This was moving into the more kind of style that they had in the 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The one that I associated with, with Ben Ubs and Broomsticks, Robin Hood, which came out in 73. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
this is definitely this kind of
style.
Which lasted till about the mid to late 70s.
Peter and the Dragon.
All this kind of style, yeah.
This is more rudimentary animation to me.
It's what I call, what I associate with the Don Bluth style of animation. Mm-hmm. In fact, it may have been Don Bluth.
Talking about dark kids films, my favorite film as a kid was Secret of Nim.
I love Secret of Nim.
In terms of those kind of darker kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. And that was a film that really allowed some darkness.
That's when he split off and actually did that. Remember he did Dragon's Lair, the game?
Yep.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
He did a lot of great films.
I bought the DVD to play it. It's just like to see it. It's easy to get through, but I remember playing that for hours. But that was great. He's trying a lot of things after his Disney
days. It's such a little simple effect, but great. Disney was so great for so many things like this, and this movie really is the studio gets to utilizing everything that it had spent so much time perfecting, like a lot of those little techniques, you know, if you went to, even if you go to Disneyland now and you see a lot of the original rides and how they, you know, use animatronics and made things feel magical and feel like they were moving, you know, and then they get to use it in this medium. It's almost like this book came along and it was just like the perfect thing and just served up right to Disney and been like, everything that you do well and everything that you've been working on here, you can use it all in one movie.
Right. And just like seeing the cane and the umbrella,
right.
Disney Studios could give personality to anything.
Anything.
Any inanimate object.
And the interesting thing is that, you know, a lot of other Disney movies that come before, so you, I mean, I'm just watching this right now, so you see the bunnies, you see the deer, you think, oh, Bambi. It's like you're reminded of all the different characters, even though they don't show up here, that, you know, that appeared in previous Disney films.
Right. Well, a forest is a forest, and
yeah.
But, you know, all the inhabitants.
See, and this is clever, too, like the idea that, you know, you have to float across this whole thing on one foot. You know, just, I mean, everything that they do is an idea. It's more dynamic than just...
Wouldn't it be interesting if someone had recorded the brainstorm sessions at Disney of how to come up with this stuff?
Oh, so interesting.
Oh, the production meetings must have been something else.
Can anyone sing like her? I'm telling you, her voice.
I know.
The purest, most amazing tone.
I was thinking about the costumes. The costumes are great, and obviously they did a lot of cleanup for this remastering, but even then, if you look how they... What they did is that they took care of her hair by having it all back and then also putting, I guess, the scarf.
Don't have any stuff sticking out.
Now, the scarf is a problem for blue screen, but they seem to have licked it, you know.
Well, they put the umbrella behind her, a good chunk of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, so it helped to cover a lot of it.
I mean, another
thing, look at this effect. I mean, they're reflected. I mean, obviously, that was, okay, we take it, we draw, we hit the cells, and we move them across.
Well, what you see in this, too, that you don't see a lot of now, too, is care in the way things are framed and thought out rather than just slapping up a digital background and having it sort of framed however it makes. I'm not quite articulating it correctly, but there's a kind of care in the way it's done.
And logic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, so definitely the craftsmanship.
It's
terms of
really
framing.
Still telling a story through each individual camera frame rather than just big splashy digital in the background and letting that try and get you through the narrative, which never does for
Michael,
me.
Michael, why do you always bring up Phantom Menace? Oh.
But I think sometimes the limitations of technology forces really imaginative people to come up with something more creative. You know, I mean...
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And it's great to have the waiters and be penguins for the tuxedos.
Yeah, and it's very Disney, you know? To do that. So adorable. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I love the penguins. I always love it. It's great.
And back to, you know, we're about to come up to, again, one of my favorite pieces of choreography with the penguins.
Oh, yeah.
And Dick Van Dyke. Again, very inventive, very classic of this film, just very interesting. You just never see it in things like this anymore.
And this sequence
is a huge sequence.
It's a huge sequence.
It's a mini film.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
It is. And if you think about where this is going in the plot, it's like, you know what? You just got to go with this sequence.
And actually, it doesn't. All it does is let you get to know the characters more.
Right.
But plot-wise, it's not doing a darn thing.
Thing is, it's an adventure. But actually, it's all character, because what it is, it's allowing us to re-explore indirectly their relationship. In other words, we know they have a prior relationship, but they're not saying, well, we did this and we did that, but they're reconnecting.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm.
They are.
And they're reconnecting in this fantasy world. Notice we're not with the kids. We're with them. We spend the time here. This is where the movies put us.
And as we said before, it's a wonderful, on a silver platter, to get to know Mary Poppins.
And to get to know what's deep
inside her.
Right, exactly.
You know? And so,
you know, I think it's all probably still fat from an narrative standpoint, but it works anyway. It's just great.
Well, yeah. That's why you have the spoonful of sugar with the music and the dance.
Exactly.
Seriously. You have the lights and the sound effects. You have the spectacle to get you through it, and it's definitely entertaining. I mean, what's more endearing than Dick Van Dyke dancing for you?
Yeah.
And Julie Andrews singing for you? It doesn't get any better.
Well, and
it
this is what you've been waiting. How long has the movie been on?
We're at 49 minutes.
Yeah, we've been waiting this long into the movie to really get into like the meat of the imagination, and they jumped into that sidewalk, and they're like, okay, here it is.
Yeah, you want some Disney magic, folks?
Right.
All right,
yeah.
Take a load of this. Take a load of this.
And you get the Disney magic, too, exactly.
Nice.
You're getting like how... I mean, I'm sure watching 64, everyone's like, how did they do this?
I'm not quite sure how that slide was done, by the way.
Well, exactly.
Am I the only one to where, you know, right, you're saying, why didn't they do some more stuff together? This was it. You always think of them as a screen couple, but they only did one film together.
Yeah, they only did one. Darn.
This is a total...
her career kind of changed in the 70s. Well, movies all changed in the 70s, too. I think that was probably part of it.
As far as, do you think people are trying to team them up for a vehicle? I will tell you that Che Che Bang Bang, the woman in that, is a Julie Andrews wannabe completely, head to toe.
Oh, sure.
And they wanted Mary Julie Andrews, obviously, and she couldn't to do other stuff or declined because she said, I already did this. It's called Mary Poppins.
Right.
But the girl they got and their
I thought she's
character
fine.
Was
I like
very
her.
Much.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is like 9 hours long. It's like a 9 hour
it's
long.
Not 9 hour. Long. It's like, not that it's long. Like 2 or 2.5 hours.
No, it's like a 3.5 hour long.
It's not
movie.
3.5
hours. It's pretty long.
It's a great movie though.
I'll look it up on the inner tubes.
I'll look it up on the inner tubes.
Well, it's a road show, right? I mean, it has an intermission break and.
Well, with the intermission, I'm sure it's long. I'm not going to count that.
But I'm saying it's long enough to have an intermission.
Oh yes, and you know where they have the intermission? Right when the car is coming down and they're going to crash into the water. I guess we'll have to do that at some point.
Oh, yay. This part's so great, too. The hole in the painting part.
Oh, yeah. Being a kid, this is everything.
Yeah.
This is, how could you not want more as a kid?
I can see why at 3 years old I was just like, I want to see it again.
Shoot, it's magic.
And my mom's like, okay, we'll go to the movies again.
But it captures that. Like, I mean, who hasn't ridden a carousel when they were younger and imagined that they weren't on the carousel anymore?
Not a lot of carousels left anymore.
No, there aren't.
Really?
It's very rare, yeah.
There's very few left in the country.
I own several antique carousel horses. Yes, they are. That's
full
part of
size?
My. That's part of my inheritance. Full size. My grandmother and my mother collected them, refurbished antique carousel horses, and there was a collection of them that was passed down to my mother from my grandmother, and now my mother has them, and... I'm pretty sure I'm going to have at least two of them one day.
I always think of something wicked this way comes when I see carousels.
You're going to need a house big enough for that one.
Yeah, I will.
144 minutes for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh.
I think...
it's a shorty.
Carousels also in today's society, I don't think carousels are enough to hold one's attention as a small kid anymore, which is, I think, is a comment on rise that had to be complete stimulus.
Right. But I think it's also exposure. If you just took children to do things like this, they would just think it's part of being a child, whereas... You know, if you only give them, you know, Game Boys and...
That's what they know.
And computers. As
opposed to go outside and play, and I don't want to see you till 6 o'clock. Which I don't think happens anymore, does it?
I
do it with my 14-month-old all the time. I just put him out in the street and say, go play. We'll see you in a while.
Don't come back here till 6 p.m.
That's right. I think this whole sequence with the horses and the poles is amazing.
I don't really do that. Don't write letters.
It was a nice
idea
to have the horses come out, leave the carousel and go on their own.
But I like how they have it so that they are scraping the ground.
Right, and the pole still is going up and down because the carousel horses may have left the carousel, but they still follow their same pattern. That's how they move.
You know, their production meeting. How do we make a move? What do we do then from that point?
Just make a move just like they always do.
Because maybe they thought, you know what? It's really strange seeing them glide across. So they have to move up and down and be really freaky. Yeah, because that gives them motion. I like that little sine wave that they're kind of...
This is an epic sequence.
It is.
And now
this
we go to a fox hunt?
Yeah, I know. And
actually, how many books did they pull from for this sequence?
Which is interesting, too, is that the person in... I mean, and essentially the people in this world are not... I like the last gag with the horse. The people in this world aren't used to this magic. Now, they're not like, oh, it's you. Mm-hmm. It's like, what's going on? Even though we're animated
Well, fox
characters.
Hunt is very British, and that represents establishment to me.
Well, this whole thing is establishment.
But there's the fox.
And there's the fox.
The poor little fox.
So rumor has it that Sweet wrote Fox on the Run after seeing Mary Poppins. Okay, I'm just making that up. All right, never mind. Sweet, Love is Like Oxygen?
Don't know what you're talking about.
There was a group called Sweet in the 70s.
Yeah. I don't know Sweet.
They
had Ballroom Blitz. Fox,
oh,
on,
I know
the
Fox
run.
On the Run, yeah.
And Love is Like Oxygen.
Yeah, you know what? Again, coming back to the language of dream, I think all this, what would feel normally extraneous from a narrative standpoint, works because in a dream, you can have all these sort of little moments that just sort of don't really follow along any structured narrative because, right. you know, it's a dream.
It's just because it's a progression of thought. It's like, oh, we're in the country. Oh, we're on horses. Oh, other horses in the country could be on a fox hunt. Oh, look, there's people on a fox hunt. Oh, we're going
to
save the fox.
Back to the dream lodge.
I'd be interested to know the running time on this animated sequence since they went into the chalk painting.
I think it's like about half an hour. With 55, we went into about 40, 30, I think they're about 35.
So they really didn't have to have much of a film around this because this is a huge chunk of running time.
15, 20. But it's all an adventure. That's the thing. And also I want to point out, even the fox is kind of surprised that the horse is coming from the merry-go-round. It's not like it's normal. Mm. So even within that, in other words, I mean, they're alive and they have the element of magic. This is just another world they've gone into. It just happens to be animated. But this is a real world.
The other thing it really says is how well done the characters and the narrative portions are of the film. Because when we were first talking about the film, that's what was really standing out to us. We weren't thinking of these moments. We were thinking of the characters mm. and the narrative and the father and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And that's what really still, you know, lingers with you despite the fact that you have these long fantasy sequences.
Yeah, they definitely made their impression known for introducing us to those characters at the mm-hmm. beginning.
Right. And then it stayed with us and then we've forgotten them and then we're going to come back.
And then
to
we
them.
Come back to it and sort of go and come back. Go
right. And here she is and she's won the race. You know, of course she does. And she's very, very humble about it all.
I think she's cheeky.
Well, she is cheeky. You're right. And because of course she would win.
Yeah,
because,
she knows it's all about her.
But because this is like Chitty Chitty.
Oh my gosh. I love the little band.
It's like you're playing pretend. It really is. It has that dream quality. It's
very childhood. Very yeah. much the innocence of childhood.
Absolutely. It's like you could, you know, as a child, you could act out this sequence, this whole thing, because it has that that quality. It's an adventure, is what it is. Uh-oh.
It's a great song. Absolutely. It's a showstopper. And it's a showstopper.
What does it mean?
It's an 11 o'clock number song.
It does look quite interesting in the subtitles.
Yes, we're getting the whole word. That's right. It's the longest word in the English language.
These lyrics are so quick. I was interested to know. I want to know how the subtitles are.
I'm pretty sure the longest word would be Abcadical Jekyll-Menachward Stewart's.
It's 26 letters.
Wow.
What's that from?
It's from Sesame Street.
Oh.
I love that song as a kid.
Yeah, I did. I love that song as a kid.
This is their dance number. Yep. This is
yep,
nice. This is a little vaudeville
yep.
number.
I love yeah. it.
It's very English music hall.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's interesting. Well, actually,
which is Julie Andrews' past.
Lovely, like, mirror work, you know. Like, I mean, they're both excellent dancers.
Well,
Dick Van Dyke never considered himself a dancer. He was never trained. He just was a mover.
Yeah.
He just got
yeah.
it. He was a hoofer. He just naturally yep. did it. He was never a trained dancer.
Kinetic sort of individual.
Is the other choreography in this British music hall
no.
style? It's just this. Okay.
Right. I would say the song warrants it.
Right.
And so if you look at what they're doing a music hall
right.
choreography.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great song.
But Julie Andrews' roots are in London music hall stuff.
I love this. They just go into like a complete vaudeville routine.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. They shifted gears. Definitely. This song, we're in a
whole different
gear.
Maybe that's who they were, you know?
They were a vaudeville act.
They were an act.
That's right.
And they both had to grow up, you know? She had to go on and have a career, and he stayed a child.
Which is sort of
man-child.
Yeah.
That's right. He's
the first man-child.
He changes jobs every day, yeah. I like how they whisper. It is like a vaudeville act, yeah.
Which would have fit when the book was written, but maybe not necessarily this period.
No, it would. 1910. Well, 1934 is when it was written. They changed it to 19.
I'm sure we don't have the actual vaudeville routines. We're probably
if you watch
1910.
Yeah. Well, they were still vaudeville.
If you watch Julie Andrews in Darling Lily and Star,
oh, I love it.
Those two films show up the music hall talents of her yeah. as well.
And back to reality, or
yeah,
and
this whatever
lever, and level of the dream,
yeah. right? And it's a little more drab. He's in black,
it's
and
the
she's
first
like
Inception.
The dark blue.
Mary Poppins
yeah,
is the first Inception.
Yeah, it's really.
That's right. So if they went into a painting within the painting, mm-hmm.
but you know what I like about this too is that there's this kind of
right into this song.
Idea where yeah. they could have just been standing there that whole time. I mean, even when I was a kid, I was okay with that concept that maybe they were standing there and they were having their imagination about the, you know, the chalk things. Maybe they walked through the park.
Poppins and Bert were just presenting it and the kids just
right, and they were just all playing this
game
together,
really
you know, and then it rains and it brings them out of it and be like, oh, yeah, we have to go about our lives.
Yeah, as a child, I don't think I necessarily needed to know, oh, did they really go into the cartoon?
Right.
Where it's like, they just did it. Well, yeah, sure. Okay.
But it does work on either level, doesn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, either way.
Yeah,
it's
this is cool.
But you don't need an explanation. And one thing, actually, with movies, at least I want to say more recently, it's been like 50 years now, that...
How is it different colors in each person's spoon?
Psychedelic.
How do they do that?
Well, how did they do that, exactly? How did they... That, now, that's a
that was a physical effect.
That's a magician's trick.
I've never understood. That's totally
a
magician's trick.
I would say they had three tubes behind that bottle.
And there was a guy feeding them from behind her with a hole in the back. Yes.
The spoons were all laden with some sort of chemical that turned them each different color. So they probably all just poisoned themselves a little bit.
I like how she gives herself rum punch. She's like,
But they each get a little of their own medicine, you know? I love that.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, they're scared at first, and she's just teaching them not to be scared. And she uses, you know, not to be scared. And, of course, she uses reverse psychology to get them to sleep.
What this movie needs is a really good lullaby song. What could they possibly have that could meet that criteria?
I think it's brilliant.
It's an amazing song.
Well, that's the thing, is that what they went through to write the screenplay and then write the songs to all meld together so well. And it works psychologically, too, as you would say, Michael.
The film starts out with this melody line, as we saw the Peter Ellenshaw matte painting at the beginning. And I think the melody line of Feed the Birds has got to be one of the most romantic lines.
Yeah.
Does it start with Stay Awake or Feed the Birds?
It's the melody line of it's chorus of Feed the Birds.
Okay, because she sings Stay Awake now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If it had been Stay Awake, would have been very interesting, because then it's like, okay, we're going to put you to sleep at the beginning. That's what...
Right. Now, I stand corrected that, you're right. Stay Awake is the lullaby song, but Feed the Birds, that's what the movie starts out with, and that melody line is the most romantic.
So let's talk about that for a second. If she's singing Feed the Birds, because what she's saying is be gracious, acknowledge that there's other people out there, be sensitive and giving of
kind.
Yourself. That's the first, in the way, the musical message that's given to us.
That's a good moral.
We take it, which is... And that's what
I'll
she,
take it.
It's what she teaches the father, essentially. To think of others, think of your children, think of the woman. Because remember, he goes to see the woman.
Be connected to the world around you.
But to yourself as well. You know, feed yourself with joy and imagination, and then reflect that onto others. You know, I mean, I think that that's kind of the whole. I think that's the overall message, is to like believe in goodness, and in joy in yourself, and then just share that.
I think it's very daring that a film does a lullaby and risks losing the audience.
Right.
Putting everyone to sleep.
All the children are falling asleep.
Especially halfway through, you know?
it's pretty courageous.
But also to research her as the...
Eternal.
That's what she's been, actually. She's been, not to denigrate what the mother does, but she's the...
She's filled a gap.
She's filling the gap where the mother, by necessity, and this is my read, of course, hasn't been able to fill the gap because the mother's asserting herself. And also is consumed in the father's house, you know, keeping the household for the father. So there's in this household, there's not a lot of room for the children, which is why they're unruly. They are not integrated. It's only when he integrates them at the end, and then everyone becomes integrated, the mother and the children, do they actually perhaps start working with the household.
I think this movie shows that the family, as individuals, are works in progress. And Mary Poppins is the catharsis to bring them to something better.
Yes. Who is that? That's not...
There's Matt Pennings.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
I love... The very storybook quality of even the names, you know, in this film. Like Mr. Barnacle, you know.
Admiral Boom. But even the backdrop, it's not a translite. I mean, that is a Matt... Either it's an actual painted psych, or it's a blue screen.
That was blue screen at the top of the house that we just saw.
Okay, and in that case, it's definitely a matte, you know, one of Ellenshaw's matte paintings.
That was blue screen.
Didn't Ellenshaw do Star Wars? One of the Ellenshaws did Star Wars.
I don't know. Peter Ellenshaw, one of the best designs he came up with that always sticks in my mind is the Cygnus ship in the black hole. A lot of people diss the black hole, but the design of the ship, of the Cygnus, is amazing, and it's elegant, and it's regal, and it's an old England-type feel. And the design of that ship, look at some, if you want to see some good Peter Ellenshaw work, take a look at that. It is the film for me. It's the best part of the film is his design.
And so now we have everyone in the household participating in the the magic of Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And
they've all been affected.
And except him. He's just like, no, can't. It's outside of me.
Well, and it's that idea again that like happiness and joy is infectious. You know, that it just starts spreading. If you just start giving into it and believing in it, eventually it's going to take over and, you know, roll through everybody in the life.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just like the bag in the beginning.
Yeah, true.
And so now they're singing the song and everyone's like, oh, yes.
The father is just...
But I love Glynis Johns. She's just, in a way, there's a bit of the flakiness to her. Just the tiniest hint. She's just a little bit on the crazy side, but it's very, very sweet.
It's a lot of light.
And he can't...
Again, yeah, he just can't... Say,
because it is the most... It is actually the most ridiculous... How did they think it up? They say, we need the most ridiculous word you could ever think of. To basically just... And actually, let's go back to the psychology, Michael. Basically, a word like this is... It's basically an amalgamation of, I don't know how many, 5, 6, 7 kind of...
Kind of words?
I'm going to say... my brain's gone. What are parts of words called? Syllables.
Syllables.
Syllables and mashed together. So psychologically, you're setting up connected meanings. And if the connected meanings have no sense, your brain has to try and make it make sense. And if it doesn't, what does that do to you? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
No, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And that's what it does. I mean, it is like the longest word you've ever heard.
To this day, little kids come up to Julie Andrews and ask her to say the word backwards, and she can.
Really?
A lot
she's,
of practice.
She's never forgotten how to say it backwards.
I want to learn how to do that. I'm surprised I never taught myself that.
I'm always a big fan whenever there's a little statue in the background looking at an actor. I don't know why. That
really?
That.
That's an odd
right.
Yeah, I know.
Actually, let's talk about the hourly explosions also psychologically.
Right, if your life just constantly being
it's
like disrupted.
It's like on the hour.
But it's scheduled chaos.
It's scheduled chaos. Yeah. It's being disrupted and he completely ignores it. In other words, it's not his job to, he's not paying attention to the disruption. Whereas the mother and the domestics are all, we have
prepared
to keep,
for it.
We have to keep the household together.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's not like, his job. Like, that's that very, like, you know, men of that era, you know?
Right. So it does fit in psychologically.
Right, yeah.
That's why it's there. Because, I mean, they put it there for a reason. To have to do that gag over, and they've done that gag like 4 times already.
It's very known that to so many cultures, men, fathers, only show their love through work.
Right.
And that's what this man does to his family.
I like how the boy, I just want to say, yeah, I like how the boy just like, walks on the sidewalk up and down, up and down, up and down.
Like just children do.
Yeah.
I would probably have
James
walked
Mason
the line of the guy.
Who's that?
It's like the kid. Yeah. How he's like up and down. Like I just like, you know, kids often do things like that. It's very realistic.
Yeah. Oh, the kids' behavior actually. I mean the psychology of the kids is actually, the psychology of the family is actually all pretty realistic here. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of surprised at this. When I saw it when I was younger, I never thought of it this way. But now that I'm older also, it's interesting I was able to see more of the father's point of view. Because I'm probably close to his age at this point, though not in the same situation. I can, obviously where my life is, I can sympathize with him more, as before he was just like the father figure.
Exactly.
Just do what you're supposed to do. So there he is. There's Andrew.
It's a very universal core to this film, trying to connect your parents.
Right.
And trying to connect your
children.
I mean, as a kid, I had, I knew what it was to have a workaholic father. And I never made the association between watching the film and thinking of him is similar, but now that I'm older, I kind of look back at it and go, oh, yeah, I can see why, another reason why this film resonated for me, because I had a similar situation.
I think
it's a film that can resonate with adults and children because of that very thing, that you're at one side of the fence or the other. The kids see it from their side, the parents see it from their side. I've grown into the parents' side to understand, to see it from that side now, instead of just the way I did as a kid.
I'm wondering, too, if there isn't a bit of a cultural touch, too, in, you know, obviously we note the changing role of women, but, you know, you're talking about the man's job was just to go away and be at work and come home. Here, we're sort of saying that maybe that's not the only case, you know, that he has more of a role than that.
We just had like a 3-second delay,
glitch,
folks. It was probably switching the layers, so... You may just want to pause a tiny bit. We'll tell you, we'll give you a little cue point. Let's see. If we're just close the door, well, we'll give you a better one. Just a second. Do something physical. Someone in here. Okay, she's opening the door right now. Okay. There we go. There's a new cue point. And Edwin is laughing.
The setup for this is fantastic, too. Like, the worry and, you know, he's not going to be okay. These children have not, they, like you, do not know what to expect.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, what is this? You come into a room, someone's laughing, and he's up in the air. What is going on?
Great character actor.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
But this gives you an idea of the episodic feel that the books had, in other words, of going on one adventure or another, like, you know, Tea Under the Sea, that kind of thing.
Right, and each little adventure teaches you something. And,
right, and they couldn't do everything, so you could...
It does feel to me that they're just collecting from the books, you know, little snippets here, a little snippet there of things that happen in the books to make the screenplay.
And I think it was effective. So it's interesting then if they had a choice...
This film wrecked the greatest story ever told for me.
Why?
I cut you off, Serge. What were you saying?
No, no, go ahead. Why did it wreck?
Because Ed Wynn was in the greatest story ever told.
Oh, my God.
In a serious role. And I couldn't take it seriously. I was expecting him at any moment to start laughing.
But actually, when you think about it, this is brilliant. What have we had now? We just had a long sequence, and then we had a home sequence. And then what do? They do a sequence where it's all about laughing.
Well, here's the best.
It is a little forced in some ways, but in sometimes you just can't help laughing at this point.
Well, also, we see here, this is like the in its full effect. This guy's just flying around a room, just completely laughing, just, and Mary Poppins is not into it, at least in the beginning.
Well, for her, it's all, she can't let herself be seen as being into it, because she's always a little removed and controlling the situation, because she's the nanny.
Right, she's the nanny, and someone's got to keep him off from getting stuck on the ceiling.
Someone has to be the adult in the room. Well, that's the thing. Someone has to be the adult in the room.
The designated driver?
She is always the adult in the room.
Well, she's
got to doesn't mean she's always stern, but she's always the adult.
She's well, always super ego to the id.
Right. Well.
Not completely, not one-dimensionally.
Right,
so, but,
right, because she is part id, she's part super ego. So
to me, she represents balance, you know?
Well, she's ego. She's pure ego. I mean, she is good balanced ego. Right, exactly.
You know, yeah, being able to, like, laugh and have a good time, but also do what you need to do when things need to get done, you know?
In a way, she's the only adult in the film. In a way. Because what I'm saying, in the sense that she's integrated. Her super ego and her id is integrated. The wife, she's still seeking something. The husband is lacking something. The kids are lacking. Everyone's lacking something. Even Bert. Bert's lacking a stable job. Bert is a man child.
But Mary
Does
Poppins,
he need to have a
I mean, if we
job.
Really want to like start breaking this down, I
oh,
mean,
we
Mary
are.
Poppins,
we are,
we're breaking it down. Mary Poppins is, you know, actually the one without the most, because she's the one who builds up family for other people and then leaves at the end and has nothing.
But she's okay with that.
I think.
Just as Bert is okay not having a stable job.
Yeah.
Maybe he's a creature that doesn't need a stable job.
So maybe he doesn't.
And maybe she's not okay with it. She's just come to terms
with it. Why should we impose a stable job on Bert?
Mary Poppins also has a certain level of vanity working for her, too.
But she's integrated it. She's balanced it out. She's comfortable with where she is.
That's true. It's not neurotic vanity.
Right.
Right. And Bert's not neurotic either, though you'd expect him to be.
They're just good-natured people. He's a good-natured person.
Yes, he is. Well, absolutely. He's like in a really crappy situation. He doesn't have a steady job. Every day it's a different thing, whether it's, you know, playing music or drawing on the sidewalk to get tips or cleaning chimneys. He has a really unstable life, but he is without a care. He knows, well, I don't want to say he knows, he's without a care. He doesn't let it drag him down, which is interesting.
You've said that he's in a crappy situation. To me, I think he's in his correct situation. He's an artist, creative heart, and if you gave him a bank job, he'd be suffocating and dying.
Okay.
He's someone who needs to go from one to the next and experience life in different ways. And so I think he's in his absolute correct environment. By not having a stable job.
I will stand corrected then.
I think that's the lesson that they're saying.
That is very
there
good.
Are people that don't need a corporate 9-to-5 stable job in order to be the most of who they can be.
The effects here, I mean, I just gave up. I'm like, how did they do everything? Because every shot was like a different trick. Seriously.
Yeah, I mean, we've got so much different stuff
that's,
going on.
That's
here.
Two different shots. That was blue screen, and they're actually flipping.
This one, I love that joke.
Oh, with the Smith, the leg named Smith.
And may I say that?
But that's the best. I know it's funny, and it just plays at the end. That's what kills the father,
right?
Because he laughs so much, and it is, and then that's It is.
It's good.
I have to tell that joke
is,
tonight.
Is she maybe a little unhappy a here, joke. Too, because she's not the one driving the magic. It's the other
Yeah,
guy.
They're having a party without her.
Well, but she's... Well, okay, here's a question. Does the magic... So the magic exists outside of her. In other words, she doesn't have to be there for the magic to exist?
I think so. I mean, yeah. And again, in this language
they're
of the dream...
Up. It's they're hooked just, into it, too.
So it is a bit of a dream... This is all a bit of a dream world.
This is not her magic at work here. This
right. It is other magic that she's kind of tapping into.
I would have think this has been
she,
a very...
She condescends to use her own magic here to come up to their, table.
She feels it's all very childish. No, I don't really... Okay, fine. I'll do it. I will adapt.
I thought this would have been a very challenging sequence as a director to...
The whole thing.
Do oh, because mainly laughing. And a cold, sterile film environment of what you have to do to shoot a film. And yet the sequence, they have to have the kids laughing and sparkling all the time.
I got to say, the kids laughing is not all that good.
It's very difficult to do. And this is an extended sequence of laughing.
Yes.
It's
Dick Van Dyke can sell the group.
Right, yeah. That must have helped a lot, too, with getting the kids to laugh, is having these two ridiculous men
I can
just
only imagine
laughing
what
full-heartedly,
they were doing
right.
to make the kids laugh.
He does so many Disney voices, too.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Who is the father of Kenan Wynn, correct?
Yes.
Edwin's the father of Kenan Wynn.
Kenan Wynn, who went on to be also a Disney star. He is... Oh, what's the joke again? And there... And we're listening to the joke, of course, because we're...
We have to...
Yes.
Just run over your cat.
And they sink.
Oh.
There they go. Sinking
they just sink a little bit at a time.
Oh. You're catching mice.
That's right.
And up they go.
And that's a great joke because you're just leading him into it's going to be sad. And you get him with the punch.
And that's where you want to see this in a theater.
Oh, yeah.
Because the audience reaction of laughing
right.
with that
right.
is fantastic.
But the Smith, the leg named Smith is... That had me laughing when I was watching it last night, and I kept on laughing.
I love her little watch.
Yeah.
Just pops out of
mm-hmm.
it. Yeah.
It's a clever addition, too.
And everyone drops down because it's sad.
Spit spot.
Once again, she's the adult in the room. We got to go. Now, I got to say, as funny as that is, it does start slowing down now.
Yeah, this is about the part, I would say.
Yeah.
But time to go home.
they kept it short. I think they did cut a song from this sequence, too, that they planned on doing, but they didn't do. Once again, Wikipedia is a great place for that.
Be interesting to see the original script to this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, all scripts go through the different, it's the sausage. You don't want to see how the sausage is. You want to see the final thing, so.
Uh-oh. Man. We're going to go back up, I feel.
That's right, because he's... He's trying his Cockney accent again there.
Oh, it didn't work.
No, it didn't work. He's got to tell another joke.
But see, it's like Uncle Albert's laughing. It's his laughing magic. It's not contingent on other people laughing.
Yeah. So he's got the magic in him.
Wow, look at Dick Van Dyke's eye makeup.
Wait, he was Uncle Albert?
Yeah.
Was he her uncle?
Possibly.
Maybe it's in the family.
It's in the family.
It's in the family. That's what I'm going to say. It's in the family. I like how Admiral Boone.
Well, she's a witch, and he was a warlock.
We don't want to say that out loud. He's totally preoccupied, and Admiral Boone's just like, are you listening?
So this is all the Disney studios, right? This whole set?
This was all shot here, right, in Los Angeles?
I mean, this is right up the street from us. This is on Ventura.
When,
the freeway.
When they had a studio, when they had the sets, because they sold off part of their lot.
Oh,
he's
so
serious. Smith joke.
Uh-oh.
And, of course, it's all ridiculous, and he can't process it, because, of course, who could process it?
Definitely not this guy.
Mary Poppins is drugging the children.
That's right. What are you doing to these children? They're crazy. And she's never argumentative. She's very seemingly compliant, and she totally gets her way.
Well, because with a spoonful of sugar, it helps the medicine go down. These are all great lessons for people to learn. Be nice.
Everything I need to know about life, I learned from Mary Poppins.
Yeah. Be nice and people give you things. it's true, though. Maybe not give you things, but sometimes.
Eric Tomlinson always reminded me of Terry Thomas a bit. That same type of British character actor.
Terry Thomas. He's a funny guy. That's the
they could be brothers. Lie.
Is she always in light blue in some form or fashion?
Yeah, it seems like that.
She was in yellow before.
Yeah, but
yeah, she did wear yellow ones.
But I think there was blue in that outfit, light blue. It seems like there's always light blue in her outfit.
Light blue and yellow. They have. Yeah.
What are they telling us with that?
I'm not sure.
And now he's reiterating.
She's in the sky.
Wait, who's in blue? The mother?
The mother. A lot.
Yeah. Well, actually Mary Poppins is in blue. They're both in blue. Both the mother and Mary Poppins are in blue. So psychologically, they're on the same page now. Get it? And I like how here he's trying to reestablish his I'm the man of the house. This is how life.
Pours the sherry again. Says this is
this is how life is lived here.
With racehorse persons,
we don't want your kind, Mary Poppins.
Why? There is a bit of a class thing here that they're hinting at.
Yeah, they don't get into a lot of class stuff in this movie, but that was a little touch of it there. Yeah.
Right to the camera. Oh, he's right below. Is he reading that? His eyes are a little weird right there.
The eye line is kind of interesting that they're doing it like
look
that.
Look at this. Look, he's reading that.
It's like right below. They're not flipping.
The way she says it makes it sound like such a formal word. No.
What they did there is actually flip the line. Actually, it was off axis because they were both. He's looking camera lens right now. Now it's correct. There, he actually crossed the axis. That's what had happened. And now she's just crossed the axis again. What are they doing?
Wow, I didn't ever notice that in the scene before.
See, now we're on the correct side.
You know what? They probably shot it a couple of different ways.
Moving back and forth. Exactly. So they would have to switch the axis. He's just literally, and now it's, it's back on axis.
Actually, you know what? What's bothering me is when you see him, he's not looking where he should be when you see the from his back.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing. They should be
looking this way, and then you see him, and flip to the reverse. Yeah.
And see, now she's just basically convinced him. Actually, no. That okay. If you want it to be sneaky psychologically, what you do is mess someone up because it's what she's done. You'd mess them up with like the eye line. If you flip the axis a little bit, you're actually disconnecting what you expect from how you're watching a sequence, and you're like, wait a minute, what? And then we become just as befuddled as him. I'm going to give it to them. Okay.
That was planned.
It was planned because that's what she did. She totally did it. She totally messed with his head. It's like, I'm taking the children to work.
So you just feel that it's off without quite recognizing why. That'd be interesting if it was done on purpose.
All this slipshot, sugary female thinking.
But this is a really well-shot film, so I wouldn't put it past them to say, you know what?
I think that's what we need. We use our expectations against us.
Use film semiotics, essentially, to do that.
Don't get sacked.
So my two favorite spots in this entire film are Step in Time and Feed the Birds.
Yeah.
Those are my two most favorite.
Mine would be the entire, another like 30-minute sequence when they're up on the roof with the chimney sweeps.
That's the Step in Time sequence, right?
It's fantastic,
What's more, aren't there two songs or is it just one song they do up there?
It's Step in Time, I believe. And then they,
You're right, it is just Step in Time. For some reason, I was thinking there was something else on there.
Version of that whole thing. Yeah.
But that's just so wonderfully shot.
I love how in this story, the children are aware that she put the idea into the father's head. You know, like they're starting
on it.
What's happening is like right about now, you see that the children are starting to kind of be thinking and getting their cogs, moving in the way that she's been trying to stimulate them so far, like stimulating them with a little bit of imagination, but also giving them chances to think and like read people. So now they're starting to get it. And even the father is a little bit in falling for her little scheme and like thinking he came up with the idea. And
they've gone down the path and now they're going to become, enough to go the rest of the way on their own.
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's
self-sufficient.
Working. It's so, working. Yeah.
The seed's planted. It's growing. She's watering it, but she doesn't need to stay because they'll be self-sufficient to go the rest of the way on their journey.
Yep.
And here's our song. So there's our idea for the sequence, is to have the cathedral and the birds flying. And you guys, do you know who Jane Darwell was?
Yes.
An actress?
Yes. She was in The Grapes of Wrath. She played
Ma Jode.
This was one of her last, I think this was her last role.
Character actress who was very famous. Yeah. Yes, she was very famous in the 30s and 40s. Worked a lot with John Ford, besides Grapes of Wrath, a lot of other films for him. And she was pulled out of retirement, and Walt Disney asked her as a favor to do this part in this film.
Yeah.
And she died shortly after.
And if you notice, it's like a dream within the dream, so to speak. This is literally, she's telling them how everything, it's shot like a dream. How they have, what's this effect, Tim?
That, I'm trying to think. It's not just a lens. There's something optically.
I think it's an optical
there,
where they basically, I guess, blur out the sides, and you just have the center focused, and you know all the background. It's all animated.
I love the choral. The choral work in this rocks.
Yeah,
the choir is awesome in this.
And it's in a way, it's a sad song, but it's a very,
it's reverent.
It's a very empathetic song. It's saying feel, you know. Feel for what this woman is doing.
It's interesting. The birds are definitely a reoccurring symbol within the,
ooh,
the film.
And then it was one of my viewings where I got very preoccupied by looking at the bird crap on the set. Poor right. Jane Darwell was covered in bird crap.
Oh, no.
I hate to wreck the mood, but...
Well, it's like a lot... Okay, let's talk about the psychology of birds. I mean, you know... She kind of scared me as a child, I got to tell you.
The bird lady?
Yeah, she is
a little...
Yeah,
she did.
Yeah.
If you combine this with a Hitchcock film, it, you know, I guess.
Not good. No, it was just as a child. You know, this was an older lady and how she looked. And you know how kids are.
I think what's sad about it is what makes it scary. You know, thinking of this, like, little old lady, like, living on the streets. I mean, I think that's...
Yeah.
What's scary. But that's what the message is, too, that, I mean, I've always felt this way about it. It's what a good thing someone who has little still giving what she has away to for some other good, you know?
And that's why she was just asking for tuppence to feed the birds. She was asking for money so she could feed the birds.
Right.
Not even to feed herself.
Right.
And this is what she's trying to teach the children, which is a message they don't hear from their father ever.
That's right.
Right.
He's not connected enough to even be aware of any of this.
Right.
Which is the lesson that
the lesson,
need to be aware.
You need to have basically a social conscience.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know.
Do the right thing.
Compassion and goodness and sharing. And I mean, every message in this movie is a worthwhile message for a child, for an adult even.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. I was implying that too. You know, it's not about being selfish, which is what he is. I mean, if you're selfish, that's all you will have. And that's all you're going to amass, and you're going to have things.
And the song just really soars with her voice singing it. I'll say that.
Oh, yeah. And once again, this was the first melody we heard at the beginning of the film.
Another painting.
Ye Old Tavern. I want to go there.
Absolutely.
And now we're away from Mary Poppins. For the first time in quite a little while, since she showed up about an hour ago.
She's
gone. She's gone for a while now, and now he's taking them along, and now we see the bird lady.
And look, David Tomlin's reaction.
He's taking them to the bank to teach them a lesson, and he's derailed by something that Mary Poppins
a huge
told
lesson
the night before, you know?
Exactly.
And he's not going to acknowledge it whatsoever. But this whole bank sequence, to me, the film just comes to a screeching halt. For some reason, for me personally.
Because it's uncomfortable and scary.
I'm aware of the running time of the film for the first time during this sequence.
Now, are you aware of it now, or were you aware of it when you'd seen it before? Because how long have you been since
aware
you've
of it,
it
when I've seen it before.
Okay.
First time viewing, of course, not as much. Right. But on subsequent, it becomes readily apparent that, I just am not into this sequence as much.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, watching it now, I'm feeling a little differently than I did last night because watching it, like, okay. And I didn't remember it as well as I, you know, had experienced it when I was young. But now it's kind of coming back to me a bit, how I felt when the whole thing, when they were being grabbed out and running away.
So, it's terrifying.
It's very scary. I mean, I remember, I'm just trying to remember to my, how I reacted as a child. And it was pretty darn scary. But that's the thing, if you look at it as a child, you're coming into the adult world, though the camera is high, it's at the adult's level, not at the kid's level.
Yep. They look little. The whole place looks stuffy. There's no color. There's
another
nothing.
Painting.
It's all top of the frame. Brown, black, and white with the red.
They're all
flower.
Old. Mm. I remember that's what I always really stood out to me when I was young.
All men,
all,
too.
They're all old men with no humor.
They're old. They have, if you look, a lot of gray, a lot of white hair, a lot of beards to emphasize that they have a lot of gray and white beard, a lot of wrinkles.
Getting back to talking about balance and psychology, you know, talk about animus and anima, female and male energy. Here is a place that has no female energy.
Yeah,
whatsoever.
None whatsoever.
And this is, and basically what it's saying is it has all old energy, and then old, but is bad. It's old but stale energy.
Well,
energy
and
that's
old
not,
time, you know, old generation, you know.
But that's not. But the point is that that's not getting anything done. In other words, it's not alive. In other words, you can be old and alive.
Well, this is, by the way, this is Dick Van Dyke, isn't it?
It's stagnant.
This is Dick Van Dyke doing his
yes,
a step
and originally it was not envisioned with him doing this part.
Right.
And they came to him and he said, oh, let's give it a shot. And they went through extensive makeup tests to see if he could pull it off.
Now, it's an go ahead.
I say it's interesting watching this now. You know, I was talking about how I thought, you know, the film might be judgmental of the mother and her involvement in the suffragette movement, but it really is so much more judgmental of the father and the status of the father's role of going to work. And here we see how outmoded that sort of and ancient and archaic that sort of way of it thinking and working is.
That
the father needs to be more involved in the family.
Psychologically, it's interesting how they've approached it. We didn't see the inside of the bank at the beginning. We see the inside of the bank like about, you know, essentially what we'll call the third act. So we've seen the father and how he behaves, but now we see
what he deals with
every day. In other words, this is a way to make him start seeming human. That's why she likes to say, well, take the children. I mean, she knows what's going to happen because she is magic. So she knows it's going to cause chaos and and do everything else. And he's the young guy and he's not that young. So you can only imagine how old these guys are.
Child and his facial reactions are killing me.
He's great.
Is anyone examining the makeup on Dick Van Dyke, his forehead and the coloring?
Yeah.
And very apparent.
It's very apparent, but you know what?
It's okay.
I never thought that was a young guy in old makeup growing up. I never knew it was Dick Van Dyke.
I never knew it either.
I always thought it was some old man. Maybe he just looked so weird because he was so old. I don't know.
I didn't know it was Dick Van Dyke until I saw it in my 20s.
Well,
literally.
So
it never occurred to me, and I watched it, and I was like, wait a minute. That's Dick Van Dyke.
He's a great job.
I as a child had no idea.
I actually really like this musical number.
Did you guys know that it was Dick Van Dyke as children?
I don't recall how I felt about it was this sequence.
And this song is just so proper and it's got a...
It's the British Empire and its establishment that will not embrace change.
Right, yeah.
It's in 4-4. It's like, what kind of... It's a bit of a march to it.
Yes.
Now, what's the lesson right there? What are they saying?
Oh, and they
instead of putting your money in the bank and going that route, he's going to use it to feed the birds, which is considered
charity,
not good business.
Well,
you
right,
know,
exactly.
On their part.
Or dream
and
or throwing there's a whole, away.
What's important? Money, finances.
There's a whole other YouTube bit that could be done here, where it's like a liberal, like a conservative tack ad on liberalism or something, where Mary Poppins is, as this an attack on capitalism, but you know, you could go a whole political thing.
Well, this movie is. I really do think this movie is really bohemian, though, like right down to the core. That I mean, that's the kind of message I think it has.
I don't think it's I don't think it's anti-capitalism.
No, I don't think.
No,
it really
but I'm
is,
saying it's saying you know you it's important to have compassion, but then they're the other extreme, so to speak. It's like where all it is. I mean, it's to the point where this old man will take this boy's tuppence. And we want every single penny of yours to invest it to make you money as opposed to you actually using it constructively kind of
you can
thing.
See it
and
as like a government
thing. They literally back him into a wall, you know? And I mean, the comment is that, I mean, he's like old as he can barely stand. He says, when fall the banks of England falls. It's only about money.
Mm-hmm.
And that the money is so old, it's decrepit, it can barely stand on its own feet. I mean, that's symbolically, that's what he's saying. Well, he's not saying, but it's what he's saying. And he's just like,
open your hand. Do not open your hand.
Right. And the guy is just,
that insert shot is so great there.
He's just ready. Look, he's like licking his lips. I'm going to take the money. you know, he didn't even let him give it willfully. And he, yeah. And he wants his money back. And this is where it gets fantastic, because now that she's trying to get his money back, and Dawes won't let go of the money. He's like, why won't he let go of the money? So you and then everyone hears it, and there's a run on the bank.
Collision. The two worlds collided at that moment, and they cannot inhabit the same space.
The children can't live in that space, can't live in the bank space, in the adult space, because they cause chaos. Or Mary Poppins knew they would, and that's why she did it.
This actually, the whole sequence is much more timely in today's world with the economies.
Yep.
And yeah. It's really interesting watching it now.
But I like how everyone out in the street hears about it like instantly. And
well, if you think too, I don't know if this is, I mean, I'm assuming that this still all is a big part of the book storyline to be written in the 1930s and to be having this kind of like bank, you know, subplot going on is very.
27 was the great big Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
I mean, and that affected worldwide. You know, I mean, there were that was felt in
There was a
Europe
big backlash against banks and financial institutions
after.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, just like there should be now. Well, there should be now, but they got bailed out because, well, they basically pay everyone off. Now, this is where they run away, and this is what I remember as a child. I mean, obviously, because they keep on running, and then they run into, like, the worst part of, you know, quote-unquote London.
Yeah, that's
and,
why it gets scary.
And this was scary. This part coming up...
Because it's, like, dark and damp.
Oh, but, Peter Ellenshaw.
But also, Susie, they're running... I mean, for me, it was like they're running through areas, like, where are they, you know... It was all strange. This lady scared the living crap out of me. I mean, as in, like, really scared as a child.
Well, yeah, this is all... I mean, this is...
this is more scary than Oliver. Well, it was at the time. It's not now, but...
Oh, yeah. No, this wasn't scarier than Oliver to me. Nor was this scarier than the part in Pinocchio where he gets turned into a donkey.
Right. Wow. I didn't see Pinocchio until I was much older.
Oh, my gosh. Maybe partially you should be thankful for that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know.
Basically,
I was scared enough by... Seriously, I was scared enough by that old lady. It was like, really? It's too much. Yeah.
Joseph Campbell talks a lot about the approach to the innermost cave and then the flight that comes after that.
This was, in a way, that was part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Only, I mean, it's very true. Well, actually, the cave for them, in a way, is the bank.
Their father's world.
And in a way, for the father, if we consider the father's arc also, the bank, having them be in the bank was part of his cave.
Well, it's that point in the narrative, you know, that sort of language is the point where you reach the pinnacle of what the character is going to become. And here, you know, the boy is given the choice of, am I going to give this money away and keep it, or am I going to, you know, hold on to it? And so he decides, you know, what kind of character he's going to be right there.
That's true. So he does have an arc. But in a way, it also works for the father, because the father is now trying to integrate his home life with the work life.
Right.
And it fails completely because now, you know, the bank is...
But the father's arc is driven really by all those around him. He does have an arc, but it's really not driven on his own actions or his own decisions. It's driven by the people in his life in a lot of ways. So he really comes to be that different person, not by his own actions, but by the actions of the people around him.
So the ones with the arc then maybe are the children.
Well, I still think the father really does have an arc, but it's just that his arc isn't by his own volition.
No.
It's by the volition of other people in his life.
Well, which is because he lives his life by what the by business and by the bank. And so he's living by outside.
He's sort of dragged, you know, through the narrative and across his own arc, as opposed to doing it himself.
And then he learns to actually live for himself at the end. And that's
he's not a participant.
Right. And then he becomes a participant. Whereas, though, I got to say, I mean, Jane, you know, as opposed to Michael is more of an arc because he got to make a decision, but Jane doesn't, even though she's older.
I don't know. I think Jane has an arc. I think even just now she's starting to act a little bit like Mary Poppins, if you notice. Mm-hmm. Michael, don't exaggerate, you know.
Okay.
They're also kind of tied together. They're kind of like two sides of the same coin.
Right, same coin, yeah.
They are together, yes. So.
And you know, while we were just talking about
Matthew
the
Garber
arc
cannot
and
get that step down.
But
Matthew Garber is
funny. He
but
is
it's funny and sweet.
It is funny and sweet.
And often in the flight, there's a character that'll come along and come help out.
And that's once again our he's our chorus. He's our narrator.
Yep. And when he was just sitting there with the children, you know, the whole conversation they just had, he was explaining what we were just talking about in the prior scene with the father at the bank about how they don't understand. This is where your dad works every day with these cold people in this cold place. And he comes home and he never complains to you about it. And he deals with it. And he, you know, the whole lesson of the whole reason why the children, you know, Mary Poppins even sent him along is so they could understand their father and see where he's coming from.
Right. And you're right, because we often have no idea what our parents' jobs are like.
Right. I mean, because they're people, too.
Well, and they are people, too, which is only something we discover later, because we can't process it as a children. You can't. It's just you already have enough to worry about yourself. Like, I have to process my parents' life? No, I can't do that. And in that sense, it's how, well, I guess with the mother... Well, they're not as concerned with the mother because the mother is at least physically present more.
Yes.
So.
Except when she goes to meetings.
But she does go to meetings. But we notice we don't go with her. They don't go with her to the meeting. They don't have to because she's got her. They know what she's doing. She's trying to become at least more a person. Whereas the father is...
Yeah, she's really just a reality of the times that has to sort of be integrated into this family unit.
I mean, in a way, I'm not saying she is. In a way, she's a child because she's trying to emancipate herself, so to speak. She's not a child, but society treats her as less than an equal person. Is what children do when they grow up.
I think ultimately, maybe the mother for me is the most underdeveloped character. That I think if there was a little bit more, I would feel like it's less judgmental towards her in a way. But that see, but if she were more developed, it might distract from Mary Poppins.
I think she's fine by me. I think she's
interesting balancing act.
Yeah, I think she balances it pretty well.
Yeah,
as far as the whole film, all the characters.
Yeah, I guess if they made her more than, you know, what would be the point of Mary Poppins?
Right, exactly.
So she kind of needs to exist on that level for Mary Poppins to really work.
Well, that was kind of my point before, is that if the father moved more towards being involved in the family than what the mother is doing. But remember, what the mother is doing is selfless. It's not just for her. It's for everyone. And that's the lesson.
It's for her children.
It's for her children. That's what Mary Poppins is trying to teach her children about.
Right.
Feed the birds. You know, think of others other than yourself. Don't be selfish. There is a wider world out there. Feel connected to it. Though the father sees it, of course, through the banking and the job and everything, but it's to the detriment of the people who are actually physically present in his
life. It's interesting that you think about that the father doesn't ever comment on the mother's life at all, that you would think he would have some disparaging sorts of remarks for her life. But
I think as long as she's not drastically affecting his.
Yeah, he's so self-involved that he doesn't really care.
Well, and he clearly loves her.
Yeah.
I mean, it's how you know he loves the kids and he loves his wife, you know.
And as long as she has the appearance of being well taken care of and healthy, and that's what he needs to know, and that's fine.
I mean, you can obviously tell that he thinks she's kind of being silly about the whole thing, but I think he's happy that she's happy.
Right.
And that, you know, she's happy in whatever she's doing.
And now Mary Poppins is in red. So that's interesting. The choice to now go to red, and then also Jane is in red. So there's kind of like the doubling. It's like who's on the same page as her?
I think it's more just to match the rooftop scenario they're about to have, to match the lighting. And
I'm very glad lighting-wise.
And Bert's scarf is red, too.
Yeah, it kind of matches. I think it's just to match the set.
It moves to different
sort of... I was trying to going through for the symbolic.
I know, but I don't know if that's real.
All right, let's go for one more symbolic thing.
Red is typically sexual, so I'll let you work on that one.
Please, let's not even go there. But then the going on the rooftops psychologically. Is there anything there, Dr. Freud? Dr. Jung?
I love the way Bert just landed.
I think the rooftop, it's just another aspect of the dream language. You know, I don't think it's something.
Well, it's in a way they're closer to they're outside the houses, but they're on top of the houses. In other words, they're closer to the sky, but they're not on the ground. So look, they're looking literally, you can go on top of everyone's life.
I love that they put it this late in the day, so it's not overly lit.
Right.
Yep.
I like that they shot at magic hour.
Yep.
It's magic hour time, and which makes the smoke from the chimneys pop even more. Oh.
Yes,
and the colors here in the psych in the background are beautiful.
It's never what you expect. I love that.
Exactly. And that's the mark of a good film. Yep. It's never what you expect. And also what I like about this is now they're on another adventure.
you know,
it's like we're going to go across the rooftops of
London,
and that's the adventure.
Well, the other thing too is the, you know, the rooftops here are also with the chimneys and everything are all very dirty as opposed to the cold, sterile environment of the bank.
Yeah.
And it's more about not putting yourself in that kind of sterile environment, but being out and
organic.
Being, you know, well, I don't know if you'd call the what came out of those chimneys organic.
But why not go out? Because they were out in the country, which was nice and clean. But now the point is they're out on the rooftops with all the soot. I mean,
because
that's
the bank was so clean and so sterile, and here now we're getting dirty. We're getting our hands dirty.
Yeah.
Well, it you're going on top of the city where all the people. This is the funniest gag. Oh, what a trooper.
He's a wise.
What a trooper. And then, of course, they took, you know, they cut so they can do the tilt.
Well, down. Yeah, you have the elevated vantage point, but you're look how dirty they're getting in the process.
And you're on top of all people's houses. In other words, you're walking across all the people's lives is my point.
Mm-hmm.
A random thing to point out that has nothing to do with psychology or hidden meanings.
Yes.
Mary Poppins is wearing the shoes that she pulled out of her bag in the very beginning of the movie.
Very nice touch.
She did, in fact, wear those shoes.
So is that the only time she's wearing them?
Yeah, this is the only time she's worn them so far.
These are the lavender ones?
Yep.
Okay, because she was wearing the black ones. Can we talk about Mary Poppins?
The dirt is actually elevating them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Can we talk about Mary Poppins' turned out feet when she lands?
Yeah, I love that. That's my favorite little thing.
What's up with that? That's like
it's
crazy,
like a little gimmick, and that's how it. That's how
major.
You got to do it. That's what I like it. I think maybe, you know, that feels kind of maybe it was like a Julie Andrews touch. Maybe it was directorial or someone came across it. But it feels like that maybe that's how you fly.
It's almost
my
favorite.
You
have to do that.
But the turnout is almost unnatural. Mm-hmm. It's so.
Well, it's like ballet. It's like a ballet turnout.
Yeah,
it's my favorite painting right there. Look at the shimmering and the water.
Oh, the absolutely, they're great.
That's my favorite painting in the whole film.
It's great to be on a rooftop and look out over a city at night.
And yeah,
when you have that opportunity,
that
it's really great.
The light change, it went to cool blue.
Yeah. One of my favorite views, you'll know this, Heidi, is looking out on the Hollywood Hills from the MGM Tower.
Yeah.
Up on
it's lovely.
Like on 11. Yeah.
When especially on clear evenings.
Oh, yeah.
No smog. Yeah.
Yeah. Or looking out, if you can, the other way towards the city. And actually, in Heat, there's great cityscapes at night.
Yeah, absolutely there.
Yeah. And now this is the song he would sing to himself several times over. So now.
This was the other song I was thinking of when they're on the roof, right?
Yeah.
Even if it's just a little bit of it. And we go right into
Step in Time's coming
up. Yep.
Yep, probably one of the best dance numbers ever in a film.
I agree.
And here we get another world of men, but a whole completely different world of men.
Now, I just want to say, Mule Bamboo.
Oh, left complete from this.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah. Okay. All right, back to Step in Time.
Well, if you want to take a social comment from this, I mean, these are all young working class men, and we just saw a whole bunch of old rich men, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they're dirty. These are the workers. These are the guys who do what Bert does. They do all the, you know, they do the work. They do the odd jobs.
I'm starting to see this as a proletariat film, though.
Totally.
Now, did Erwin Kostal do the arrangements, musical direction on this film? He did Sound of Music as well.
I think that sounds familiar.
Because
this
sounds like his
the
arrangements.
Again.
The arrangements are fantastic, but this whole Step in Time arrangement is awesome.
Yeah,
musically.
The choreography is just great on this one.
They had to rehearse during a heat wave.
Look at that. I'm running across the rooftops.
They had to rehearse during a heat wave in this film, and it was... barely tolerable for the dancers. They had to rehearse outside, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
Why do they have to rehearse outside?
Yeah.
Ooh, nice visual effects shot there.
There's footage on YouTube of the 16mm rehearsal footage of them outside doing this.
Because they just couldn't
keep
it cool enough in the
studio.
We're
going to have to look a lot of things up on YouTube after this.
Yep.
Not a dancer. Come on, Dick Van Dyke.
In terms of set to play on, this must have been a fun set.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
They are running on rooftops.
I know. That's great.
It's so fun.
There's the foot, a 1 foot stable, you know.
It's the cut to the dog shot of the scene.
Dang, you know, every
that's
dancer
right.
in town.
It is the dog shot.
Every dancer in town wanted to land this gig. I'll tell you that much.
There's a great move coming up. This one. Now, here, obviously, there's some blue screen going on, but.
Just looks great.
In terms of the dancing and the visual effects, because okay, see some.
They do some great stuff with the chimneys themselves as an Irish jig. There's an Irish jig.
Oh, yeah,
change,
I love that part.
And they do the footwork over the chimney where you think they're going to fall down through it.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Was it? I mean, it's like so many little things.
Here too in the bank, that stillness that you felt where you felt like the film came.
The guy was doddering and he's falling over.
Here in the bank, was that stillness, and here it's so kinetic up on the rooftops.
Well, you've got angles because you got the sloped roof over there, so you got that to work off from a choreographer's point of view, and you have props. There are chimney sweeps, mm-hmm. which are two great tools to be able to use and be inventive with. Plus, you have the chimneys that they do the dance number on that I just mentioned. So you have a lot of invention to work from.
And it's, I mean, and this part of it is this, you know, this is their third adventure with Mary, and this is what she's showing them. She's showing him, well, even though she didn't want to go up on the rooftop, she's like, okay, fine, we're going to do it. And she's showing them, this is how you, in a way, can live your life. Not to live it, but, you know, to have fun.
Embrace joy. Yes. Now, Julie Andrews was not a trained dancer, and you'll notice the choreographer, they do a lot of handing her off, and the guys are doing all the work dance-wise, and then she has a spot where she sits down and she watches them dance.
She's pirouetting very well there. Well, she does, because when you pirouette, the whole point is to bring your head around, let the body follow. Or maybe they just did that optically.
Now she's going to watch them dance, so they get to do all the work.
Yes. That's why it's called Mary Poppins. She is the queen.
But she also doesn't have to do the dance steps.
Exactly.
Great painting work there.
Now, is
there's
that
a jig? No, what they're on is there, but around it is a painting. Now, that's a wonderful silhouette.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
I think that's only two dancers, and they just use them
over and over?
Yeah.
Well,
I think, yeah. It's not like a whole bunch of them. Maybe three dancers. That was cool.
Nice. Yeah.
That was nice.
Have any of you seen the live show?
No.
I'm curious to see it.
I'm curious too. Is it playing here? Or it was playing
it
here?
It was here, yeah, at some point recently.
I think when I was in New York, I looked at it. It was like $150 for a ticket. I'm like, forget it. All right. Now here, they're on this banister. Are they really on a banister?
I think that was...
That's what I'm
it's painted in front of. Well, that's. Well,
no,
I don't,
it's like a stage up there.
Yeah.
It's got to be. But how they did that, because if you look at
it's the pain.
See?
Right there it is.
Now, this was the gag where they're doing the handstands, and this is against blue screen, but obviously there's a bit of a drop. I mean, look at that. Well, okay.
There
was a lot of tricks going on there, but still, that was.
But still, these dancers are doing a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. You now still got to sell those tricks.
Right, yeah.
Now we got our prop.
And this always sells it. Oh, look, it's Mio Bamboo.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure.
Mio Bamboo showed up later, and I didn't mind.
The little kids just jumping.
They had the time of their lives in this number.
Yeah.
Absolutely, by all that dancing.
Yeah. Oh, I love this.
That's a great shot.
Nice. I know. And then, of course, now.
By Hottentots. We are being attacked by Hottentots.
Empty the shot lockers.
Prepare yourselves.
We don't stomach Hottentots well.
That's right.
No.
What we do is we shoot fireworks at the Hottentots.
I love it.
Handsomely now. Teach the beggars a lesson.
The old conservative world isn't going to...
That's right. It's not going to have a bunch of these guys dancing on roofs. Can't have that. No. Well, he really is like old empire.
Right. And he has nowhere to direct it, you know?
Yeah, nice excuse
for
color.
So he has a ship on his roof.
Yeah, so he's living his fantasy out, exactly.
Nice excuse for some great color
work.
Oh, yeah.
And it shines so beautifully, you know, against all that very monochromatic background.
I like how she's all calm. And
boom!
Nice shot. Well hit, he says well hit. He's like, oh no.
And that's what I like
He's a good sport.
Yeah, he's a good sport. Like this, you know, Admiral Boom isn't really out to war. You know, he's just playing game. He's just playing pretend too.
He's playing pretend with fireworks and cannonballs.
And I like the continuation of the number in the house.
Yep.
So now this is essentially bringing the chaos into the house.
Talk about chaos.
Rita Shaw.
Covered in
ash.
Yep. We've brought the dirtiness into the house now.
Yeah, right.
I love the idea too with
collision
this song
of worlds.
That you can say anything, and if you just say "step in time" after it,
yes,
it's part of the song. You know, like
it's like an English limerick game.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right. Everything. Oh, I love how they just did that flip, and she's like, "Oh, okay, I'll dance." She's such a sport in this. It was great. She did that gag.
No, even totally the mom. Good. The mom's like, "What's going on?" But
okay,
right.
Fine.
Here we go.
Right.
So the father's world is now almost sort of changing. Yeah.
See, and they're finding themselves in this world. The mother said, "Woman's votes," so they started going with that. Yep. So they're all able to integrate themselves into this. But the father,
right.
Watching his world just change.
This is about the world changing around you.
Yeah.
This is what it is. I mean,
how are you going to adapt? How are you going to get mixed into this?
Right. And he's been resistant, though he's not our main character once again.
The father has the moment a little bit later on where he decides which character he's going to be.
I like how Bert's just like, oh, I'm into it. And what I love here is they're all leaving and they're all, thank you for having us, sir. Thank you, Governor.
Yeah, they're just good people.
That's
yeah.
right. Thank you for having us over. Okay. And Michael tries to leave.
He wants to go with them. He wants to be part of that world.
Of course.
Gosh, that kid is adorable.
Yeah. And now notice how this echoes the
nannies being
blown away at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then they all disappear.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a different archetype, though. Instead of being blown away, they're dancing away.
Right.
But they're still... But then you have to... Then who's being blown away? Whereas the nannies at the beginning were the...
It's a great peel-off right there, the way it's choreographed.
Oh, yeah,
and
it is.
And it's the point. And notice, they hold. They hold till everyone is gone. Mm-hmm. They don't
and
cut
the music.
Away.
The music is awesome.
And then it's empty. And it's like as if they were never
there. Never even there. Yeah.
And look, it's still. Yeah. They held that for like 3 seconds.
It's a great way to end.
This really is a great film.
It is. And look lots of craftsmanship.
Look at David Thomas. He's like, what is going on? And she's just not taking any of it. She's great. I'm going to remember this. I never explain anything. That's what I was saying about integration. She doesn't have to explain. She just does not have to.
Right, like, because she accepts what she does and the choices she makes and the actions she takes.
Right, well, you can like it or you cannot, and then that's it.
She's got the sublime thing going on. She's operating at a completely different level than everybody else.
Right.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
She's the, enlightened monk or whatever you want to...
I find this... it's interesting that Dawes Sr. is played by Dick Van Dyke. And is there
which
anything?
Which is the antithesis of Bert.
Right. Yep.
Is that what it is? It is the antithesis.
He is,
of Bert.
Yeah,
it's like
the exact,
polar opposite. Okay. All right.
Even down to the kinetic energy thing and him just being so stationary as the old man.
Right. And now he knows that his world that he was trying to hold together, and we can see that sympathetically. The father.
And you can see the children seeing it. They mm-hmm. saw him, for
exactly.
a reason on the phone with them, Now what they saw at the bank and what they were told, in their little lesson, now they're seeing it.
To me, it's a matter of embracing chaos. I mean, mm-hmm. you had the chimney sweeps come through that house, all the dirt, everything that was brought into his controlled, he's trying to control life and you can't. You need to surrender to ride in the ride. Like Parenthood. Ever see Parenthood? That movie?
Yeah.
And there's a whole sequence built on the kids are destroying everything. Instead of getting upset and trying to control it, embrace the joy in it and let yourself go. Enjoy the ride of life rather than trying to control it all the time.
Well, it's interesting what he's saying here. He's singing about or talking about what his dreams were for his life, which is the first time he's almost talked about how to live his life. Now this is about how he had envisioned his life. And now... because of what's happened around him and affected him, it's all his dream, his vision. So as he perceives it, as he's experiencing it right now, is all falling apart. He knows he's going to be sacked, and that's it. Everything that he'd lived for. I mean, even the music supports it. The music's very sympathetic to him here.
And it's about, are you able to change or not? And that's what the establishment in the bank was all about.
Well, I think it's more than that. He says, and now my life ambitions go with one fell blow. He's not at the point of changing yet. He's still, I'm going to be the bank president.
But he's at the point of making a decision.
Well, yeah, he's there. He's almost there.
Doing something upon his own volition and not having everything be affected.
But he's still on that other side. It's like, I've been pursuing this and pursuing this. I've built my life, and now it's being taken away from me, and I am powerless to do anything about it. But he's still on that side.
Is that he thought, to me, it's all symbolism. I mean, the bank and the economic establishment there, you think it's going to take care of you and the system works. And it's all, well, when life hands you, you know, something, you get obliterated in some way, life comes around. It's what happens when you're planning something else. Are you going to embrace it and change, be able to change with it? Or are you going to be destroyed by it because you can't change?
Right.
Which is economic establishment and banks and civilizations and economies. Are you going to change, or are you going to let that be, do you in?
But I also think in terms of the arc of like one's life, when, you know, if one's been pursuing something, a career for a number of years, and you've built stuff up, and then you hit, you're like, I mean, where I kind of sympathize with him is you hit a point where he's like, this is not going to work anymore. I see it all, basically, it's all going to go away. There's nothing I can do with it. And it's how you move through that, and we all run into that at some point, especially, you know, now where we don't, you know, we have jobs for 25, 30 years. Mm-hmm. We're lucky if we keep jobs for 5 years. But when you have to readjust your life's priorities based on what the outside world is doing, and you can go in a positive direction, but it's still very painful to go through. Mm-hmm. And this is what he's going through. He's like, he knows, I'm sacked, this is it. And Bert's saying, you just got to find a way to do it, because Bert's done it.
You know, it's interesting, when you look at it that way, that...
he's got such a sympathetic look.
Yeah, he does.
Dude, I am so on your side, but you have to take the time with your children, and that's what's going to save you, and this is your lesson.
Earlier, I was, noting that... the character reminded me of my father and that sort of thing. And I'm looking at the own decisions, the decisions I made in my life, and that I intentionally became a freelancer at a point in my life, and, you know, not necessarily consciously, but maybe to avoid, this sort of thing. So,
That's interesting. So you became a freelancer so you could spend more time with your family.
Well, not so much spend, but not slip into that mold of thing, that way of living and that way of working that then affects the rest of your life and affects how you are with your family. Right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So,
right.
And like I said, not necessarily consciously so, just because that's the way it worked out.
I think we're seeing that this film is just as much for adults.
Absolutely.
As kids.
That's kind of the point I'm
right, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Slowly trying to get at, I think.
I mean, it appeals to the child in us, you know, and to when we first saw it as children. But now, you know, like I said, now I can see it from his point of view, which I've never done before.
And we come back to Eric Thomason here to show that pretty David. His arc and his character, this is his movie.
Eric Tomlinson is his brother.
Is what?
Eric Tomlinson is his brother. It's David Tomlinson.
Oh, that's right. He's a recording engineer.
Oh, Eric, is he?
Yeah, he recorded Star Wars and all the great film
scores. Okay.
That's why I'm saying that name. Thank you for correcting me, though.
That's okay. Look at that. He's just, he's gone from being such a stern person, barely under control, to, you know.
Well, because they both learned a lesson. He learned a lesson, the kids learned a lesson.
Yeah, exactly. And he's connecting. He's actually, well, he's learning to let go now. I mean, look at this. This is like his walk.
And now we see where he's reaching the point where he has to make decisions and do things on his own.
And here's Feed the Birds.
Exactly, Feed the Birds.
It's actually the bridge.
And it's actually, so once again, going back to what music did they choose to play under this? And we see his journey. I mean, on his way to
look at that shot.
It's a great painting.
It's great, which we never see him go to work.
Even with the wet street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it has to be wet. Mm-hmm. And it's at night. It's not during the day.
So that's, I can see the shot. It's an overlay over, because the smoke is moving in the background, so they shot the whole aperture that way, but they overlaid it with the silhouette and everything, the framework of the trees and the fence and all that.
And even this, I mean, they didn't really try and hide that that's a painting. I mean, we kind of know.
Absolutely. And again, because it all works within the language of the dream.
Yep. We're taking like 30 to 45 seconds to see his journey to there, and who does he
and
see?
And seeing
right
him thinking, you know, absolutely. You see it physically.
And he goes to where the bird woman should be, and she's not there.
You know, you need that moment. You were talking about Heat earlier. It's like that scene in Heat where De Niro's driving the car, and there's just nothing but that quiet, and he's driving and thinking. And this is that same kind of moment.
Right.
So is the reason why she's not there is because now he needs to be that? That's what that's saying?
I think it's
that he can take that form in his own life
rather
than her having to
lead
be
a horse to water.
She could be there, but
be
the thing
one
is,
to decide whether or not to
drink. I see it as more a matter of he wanted her to be there so he could see it and get in, but she wasn't, in other words, the timing's not right. he missed her. He missed that time to be kindness. I mean, he's literally on his way to get, be sacked, and there's nothing that's stopping that. He's like, he's walking. In fact, watch carefully. When they come in here, it's funny because you've got the security guard, or whatever I call him, security. He comes in.
The doorman.
The doorman. But then notice there's another doorman. I never noticed this as a child, but he walks in front of him and behind, and they're walking through this cold, quiet place. And watch what the other doorman does. And listen to the music. The music's martial. It's like he's being walked to his death.
Right.
To be executed.
Mm-hmm. To trial, at least.
You know. I mean, it's very...
Here, too, you're talking about the rooftop set. Notice there's not a lot of angles here. It's all very vertical.
And we don't...
There's not angles, really, at
very,
all.
Very tall ceilings. We don't see the ceilings. It's not low. It's very, very high, which is also part of the art. I like that little touch. He's rubbing the back of his legs.
And make,
that makes him human. It's not like I'm there. He's all tentative. He's like, oh.
You know, it spoke differently to me.
Look at that. Look at the darkness.
Again, approach to the innermost cave.
Yeah,
we do it again.
Spoke differently to me. For Jane Darwell not to have been on those steps was that now you can carry the torch the rest of the way.
Oh,
it's
okay.
That he can be that in his own life, that he can be that person now, and he can take her place because it's something that can continue on from one person to the next who can come to that in their life.
Right.
And that was his point of reckoning to become that now.
Look at all the red.
That empathy.
Yeah.
So it's all red. You got the red flowers. You have the red carpet. You have the red curtain, and it's all black.
Red and black.
This is interesting that they tie this into to the colonies and how it basically, you know, caused a problem at the bank.
Right. They're talking about revolution. They're talking about change.
Yeah.
This is what's bad about change.
Yeah. It upsets the banking business.
Wow.
He's not very kind to the banking business, is it?
A little dig at Americans and tea drinking there. Like that.
I got to say, I never saw all this in this film on my previous viewings for whatever reason.
Yeah,
I
didn't either.
I never saw all this.
It's a wonderfully layered and complex film.
I think when you're a child, you don't see this part. That's why this part's boring as a child. You're like, what are these adults talking about? I don't care.
Then you get to be our age and you over-intellectualize it all.
It's like,
So Mary Poppins is the film of a lifetime because you grow into it as you grow older.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say here, basically, you know, here he is running into the business establishment and they demand a certain behavior and anything in your sphere will reflect upon you. And they're basically, I mean, they are stripping him of his standing, because not only is it a career, it's his social status.
It's his.
they destroy the flower.
His identity
completely. He doesn't have a home one.
And look, and I love this with
doesn't have a family identity. And
then just to emphasize this with the umbrella, I like this. No, not that, because the umbrella is a status symbol of who he is. And Dawes Senior is just so happy about it that he's being destroyed. That he's not. You're not conforming, so you will be destroyed.
But that's also part of the path. You know, it's like the Buddhist thing of you have to get rid of your sense of self before you can, you know, progress. And they're here, I mean, that's exactly what's happening to him. His sense of identity, his sense of self has to be dismantled before he can...
Before he can embrace supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
And now in his goofy hat...
It's building. It's building.
Yeah, and then he pulls out, of course, the prop, the tuppence. It's in the same kind of shot.
And there he goes.
Now he's laughed for the first time in the film. So you see, it's
a great release because you've never seen him like that in the whole film.
And it's the psychological value of that word broke him, started the course of him breaking up psychologically.
Exactly.
I'm sticking by that one.
No, it's good. Agree.
In fact, I'm going to say it tomorrow. In fact, you know what? You should say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious once a day, every single day.
I'm in agreement. I'm in agreement on that one.
Oh, and here we get the joke.
You have the
particularly
joke.
In a moment of like
it's a real
severity.
Snapper.
Choose your time wisely. Yeah, when you say it.
Yeah,
when the world comes slamming towards you.
Yeah, that's when you just need to stop and say that word.
Right.
Yeah, maybe it'd be a much better world if everyone did that.
Yeah. What's the name of his other leg? I'm going to tell that joke tomorrow, too.
Those meek little men.
He doesn't even understand. It's like, I'm not trying to hurt you. Here, take the tuppence. Go ahead. Take the money. Don't care. He says, I don't care about the money.
See, he doesn't know what he's going to be doing. He doesn't have that.
Right. And
he doesn't care. He likes not knowing.
And he's embracing.
But he's embracing all the things.
I might just fly a kite.
All the things that the children told him that they did. All the children, not his own things. Not like, I'm going to take up this. This is all the stuff that he learned from the children that they said they did. So he's going down the children's path as opposed to any other path.
Those epiphany moments are always such a tightrope, too, because they can become dangerous and, like, preachy and that sort of thing. So
I love this.
But exactly. But this is where the gag really
This is what
off.
Kills him.
Yes, it does kill him. The joke kills him. And all he says is the punchline until he gets it. And I love when he gets it.
Because that's what it is. It's laughter's infection, infectious. Goodness is infectious. Joy is infectious.
He can't integrate it.
But he gets the joke now. But that's the thing he does integrate. He gets the joke, and what does he do? He starts floating. he starts floating. Which is kind of...
Oh, the wind changes.
Oh, yeah, and the wind changes. And she said she'd leave when the wind would change.
Now is that symbolic as well?
Well,
figurative rather than literal, a wind changing. That changed the wind of his life.
Yeah.
The father, and when the wind changes, she goes.
Yeah.
In the book, well, in the beginning of Mary Poppins Comes Back, they talk about how, you know, whatever, it's the book, it's different, but they talk about how Mary left suddenly. No one knew that she had left. She left a note saying au revoir, that kind of thing. Which I never really thought about, but in a way, you know, she does say to the children, we'll just go, but she never really says, she doesn't say goodbye. But they know she's going. This is like It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
They don't know where George is. And it, you know, and she's waiting. Oh, no. That's horrible. Ellen Cook.
They have no couth.
But she's funny. Can't blame Hermione badly. Arthur Treacher's great. This is a good gag, actually, that he's on the phone and it plays itself out. But in a way, it is like It's a Wonderful Life, because George comes in and now he's essentially come back into the world of being connected. Oh, my. Now I'm seeing It's a Wonderful Life.
And Angel's going to get its wings.
No, because George was disconnected from his life. He allowed himself to get disconnected, and now he had to reconnect. Okay, and by being disconnected, he went off into the fantasy world.
Yeah, it's the same structure.
Yeah. Oh, and they're kissing. They're kissing for a long time there. Yeah. Okay, that's been 15 seconds.
It's a bit of...
And it's like George again. It's like, yes.
A bit of Ebenezer Scrooge too.
It is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to... Yes, right. That's right. I don't care. I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be in jail. Aren't you happy? The whole thing.
He'll take the biggest goose around.
That's right. Well, I was talking about It's a Wonderful Life, but it's basically all the same thing.
Yeah, it's having, that same archetypal epiphany moment, you know.
So it's interesting. They've taken the main characters from these things and made him a minor character in this film, because he's the one with the arc. Yeah,
you could argue that almost that this is the house and everything that goes on is his own sort of psychological makeup, you know.
Oh, that they're all extensions of him,
right?
Oh man, that hurts.
Which fits into the whole dreamscape quality of it all,
right? And then
they patched it with the New York Times,
and now they're patched.
The New York Times, but the London Times.
And now they're integrated again because the parents are together and the children come down. We can go fly a kite, and they forget completely about Mary Poppins.
Yep.
The ego kite has been restored.
Which was destroyed at the beginning. Well, he destroyed it when he was trying to fly it and it flew into a tree. Which I think is actually at the beginning of this book, the second book, the kite thing. I don't know. Whatever. And now who's singing? He's the father singing. He's singing a joyful song about flying a kite, about...
Let's go let that ego kite out into the world.
Right. And, of course, the joke is reemphasized with Archer Treacher when he's on the phone with the police.
It's a great song.
All the songs are great.
They are, but I mean, this is a great one to end on. I think it's probably one of the better
written songs.
Which also song.
Has wonderful choral work. Yep. That comes in
that's
the
what
end.
I censor. Go Flack. It's like, whoa. I didn't mean, so they even work that into, that was a gag they set up.
Mm-hmm. There's a payoff.
Yeah.
I mean, it really sums up the whole message of the film, which is not to, you know, cloister yourself away in like a bank, but, you know, let yourself out into the world. And know.
And the winds of change, instead of letting it blow you away, go fly a kite.
Go
it propel your kite.
Well, but when you fly a kite, it's like surfing. I mean, you've got to ride. You've got to feel the wind. You've got to feel the forces of nature. Oh, that's a beautiful
great expression on Mary Poppins' face. Yeah. She knows the score right there.
But she knows that she's done her job because her job was to bring the family together.
Was that the last time we see her? Is that the last time we see her?
No, we see her float away.
I mean, as far as her face, and that was the last close-up.
I think that was the last
close-up, right?
Yeah, maybe.
We just see like a painting of her or something.
No, we see her come out. We see her come out the
door.
Yeah,
she comes out the front
door.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She comes out the door. She talks to Andrew.
You're right. Okay.
And it really kind of sums up why she's not overly affectionate with the children, because she doesn't want to get
in their way.
Well, she doesn't want to get too. If she gets too tied to them, it makes things that much.
And she doesn't want
they can't go the rest of the way on their own.
And she doesn't want them to get too attached to her. Really poorly. Oh,
this is what
great.
I love. They changed the world, man. Yeah. They changed the whole world.
Wooden like named Smith, exactly.
He died.
and he actually showing some emotion now. It's like, I'm sorry.
Aw.
Yeah, there you go. So now he's back in. And by letting go, he was able to find his next step, which is, it so happens, at the bank, but it'll be a better...
But it's different now.
He's not going to run it the same way.
The bank.
He did exactly, because now wooden leg named Smith, exactly.
I would like to say that just building a kite like that and trying to make it fly doesn't really work the way they make it look like it works in this movie.
Now that's
are you saying it's romanticized?
That's David Tomlinson's voice, playing the parrot. Yeah. See, she says that, you know, she's done her job. And she says, here you go. Which is the mature way to look at it and to integrate. It doesn't mean that she doesn't feel. It just, she knows how to parcel it out.
And he says to her, you know, fool me a bit. So she has something else actually going on.
I know exactly how you feel about the children. Yes, she did in this case. Because this is the Mary Poppins story. So we didn't see the people down the block or the other ones. It was these children that particularly affected her. That's why we saw this
story. I have
a
feeling, though, that this is how she feels about all the children.
True, but we did see this story. We didn't see the other one. And this always made me cry when I was a kid. I'm talking about 3, 4, 5, 6.
It was like, a nice little narrative bit with the parrot, too, because it gives a way of doing her inner monologue without her going into an actual monologue.
And it's the only time we've had that. It's great. I was so sad that Mary Poppins was.
And it's so well set up because you're watching the parrot the entire time thinking that it's probably going to talk at some point, and then you get the payoff at the end. Mm.
And I like how basically they cut to the shot there where she actually just thinks like she's handling the parrot on his face.
End on a spoonful of sugar to be a big melody.
That's what you do. You end on with a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine, which we've just gotten, go down.
Well,
you know, I think this is better than Citizen Kane.
I know. We've talked it up so much, but it really is a wonderful film. And
it's
I think of all the ones, you know, I've done so far with you, that watching this again has reinforced that more than any other that I've seen about what a complete film this is in so many ways.
Yeah.
And not necessarily even like in a traditional way, in the ways we were talking about the narrative and the narrative structure, and that it kind of just goes off on these tangents, but it all works. It's just, it's
because
unique and amazing thing.
It combines character, plot, and spectacle. Mm-hmm. And then, the music.
Yeah.
So well.
For me, it's Disney's finest hour.
Yeah.
Film. Yeah.
At the very top of everything that they could ever do. The number one achievement.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like how actually you see the Da Vinci, I think, next here for him. You see Da Vinci?
Da Vinci.
Before they came up to the.
Even his name had kind of a kinetic energy there at the end. That's wonderful.
Exactly. Wow.
Yeah.
There's so much to say. I mean, there's either others or more stuff in there. I was like, oh, there's that. I mean, but that's what makes it a great film. You can, as an adult, you can look at it, but it still can appeal, you know. as a story to watch as a child with a character works out.
Not too many films where you can take the whole family and the kids will get what they need out of it and it'll play on their level and the adults get a whole separate movie.
Yeah.
Playing to them. That's yeah. great.
It's a great something for everyone. Film.
Something for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, so you'll be watching this several times with Logan, and I'm sure you'll see that.
Absolutely. Probably,
at some point, he'll be like, Daddy, can we see it again?
Can't wait for the Blu-ray. That's going to be awesome.
That's been, I've been reading, like, that was supposed to come out in 2009. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, right?
I don't know. I hadn't heard that, but it should be wonderful.
That's one I'll definitely get. So, wow. That was pretty good.
Excellent.
I think we did that one pretty well.
That film does not age.
No, not at all. I learned some things.
Neither does the imagination behind it either. It's just.
Oh, I like that. The menu is the waiter holding up, open the menu.
Yeah.
Ah, menu. It's menu. Get it? Ha ha.
The menu.
Oh, sorry. I get it. That's right. That's really pretty good. So.
Okay.
Well, it makes me want to go fly kite.
Absolutely.
Up to the highest height?
Up to the highest height.
Nice.
Makes me want to read Mary Poppins.
You have to let me know it is. Some
point. I don't think it could be better than this. Sorry, but
I think at some point that I've started reading. Well, seriously, I read the first 35 pages in 15 minutes or something like that. So it was really a pretty easy read. And I could actually reading it the style I could see reading this to a child. It definitely is
a children's book.
It is, but I mean, a little older, but that you can read through it and it is easy to digest. I'm curious about how that works.
Do we know P.L. Travers as far as other work?
I can look it up, but this is her big thing. Actually, apparently Walt Disney was after her since 1935.
Oh, I heard those stories that she was an absolute witch.
I didn't read that. Wikipedia once again is my source. That basically he was pursuing her and she was like, nah, this and that and all those kind of things. And finally he convinced her and they got through it. And at some point she objected to something. He said, listen, this is our movie. So we are, this is how we're doing it.
What I'd read was she objected to everything. She would not let them. She was not satisfied with anything they were doing. And she was a roadblock on every issue all the time. And he had to put up with her. Until finally they were able to get her loose. But she was this pit bull, this mean woman. That's what I read.
So yeah. Mary Poppins was her. Well, actually, maybe the book was more. The book Mary Poppins was a bit more her alter ego.
Yeah, right.
I can't see, her thinking they're destroying her work. I mean, what they did was amazing. I haven't read the book, so I don't know. But I think everything I read was she was fearing that they were destroying everything that she'd written.
Which I could see, that could happen. Who do you trust? And Disney had never done anything this big. But she must have been somewhat happy afterwards, especially, making some money from the book sales, I'm sure, after this.
Have there been any other musicals where the music was this good in something that was just written as a film only?
I don't know. I was going to say Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which actually is based on an E.M. Fleming book. For me, the music rivals it. I don't film-wise, craft-wise, we'll do it at some point. We'll look at it. But
I mean, an original score written for just a film only where the music is this good, I think Mary Poppins may take the cake.
Newsies? Yeah,
I
mean,
Newsies. Yeah.
No, but I mean across the board, song-wise, this is...
You can't compare it with another Disney. That's almost unfair.
Xanadu. All divs were off. Oh. Xanadu. Hey, the score, Xanadu, actually, most of the score is pretty good because it's ELO. What ELO did was good. But it doesn't rival... This is of its kind, too. It's of its time and it's of its kind. It's the Sherman Brothers. They did this. They found a great, good pop musical niche that they inhabited for a good part of the 60s. And I think by the time the 70s came, even the 70s, because they did Bed Knobs and Broomsticks too, and which kind of went away by the mid to late 70s, because times changed.
But I would say my immediate reaction is this is the best Mary Poppins music.
If not the best, it's
musical,
one of the best.
Written just for a film.
And
Just agreement. Yeah.
I'm looking at it as, I'm still wondering, is this one of my favorite films? And I'm like, I'm just trying to think back through. I can't remember the experience as a child. That's the whole thing. But I know it was my favorite film. And obviously, I didn't see it like we saw it today from the adult point of view. But from a child's point of view, it was just, I love this film.
One of the points I was going to make earlier is, some of my favorite books. The Sun Also Rises is a book I've probably read a dozen times over my life, and it's just a book that the first time I read it, I was in high school, and now I read it, and it's a completely different animal for me. I see the characters and everything from a completely different light,
right.
And I think that's really a testament to great art is when, you know, it's not something that you attach onto at a certain point in your life and then later, you know,
it's
has no
ageless.
Meaning to you, is that you at a different point in your life, you find it again and it has a whole new meaning that you didn't see at that time. And that really is a testament to what artwork can be.
Right. I'm trying to think of other. Cool. I can't. I know there's other movies that I've watched or books that I've read a few times. Yeah. But I think it's just remarkable that this one holds up so well. But I mean,
it's a deep movie. Who knew it was so deep?
It is. It is. So, well, on that note, we're going to wrap up this film grok commentary for Mary Poppins. I'm sure we'll find some other Disney films to do at some point in the future, but this is one of the best films ever, in my humble opinion. So,
agreed.
Are we agreed?
I agree.
So
as
say
I
we
said,
all.
I think it's the
so
best.
Say we all.
It's the finest
so
hour for Disney.
All.
Complete. Is this a perfect film?
It's hard to beat it. I mean,
practically perfect.
Practically every way.
In every way.
In every way, as it should be. On that note, this has been
Michael Smith
and
Tim McMillan
and
Heidi Hilliker
and Serge Delpierre, and this has been Film Grok. See ya.